morning. I used to. We're going to call the meeting of the Board of Tech Co. registration to order. Mr. Winter, if you do a roll call, please.
Andre Angel.
Here.
Jack Gilmore.
Here.
Neil Jones.
Here.
Jason Poos.
Here.
Jason Madison.
Here.
Carmen Wyckoff.
Here.
Stephen Ooh. Knoll.
Here.
Andrew Everett.
Here.
Eugene Montgomery.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Next is the call to the public. Members of the public may address the board during this call to the public for no more than 3 minutes. Board members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are appropriately noticed for discussion and legal action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed in a future agenda. So is anybody here wanting to speak about an item not on the agenda that would like to be heard? Okay. We'll move to item four on the agenda, the adoption of minutes from last month's meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I move we accept the August 28th board meeting minutes.
Okay, we have a motion.
Second.
And a second. All in favor of approving the minutes?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Accept.
Okay. Thank you, Gene. Then we also have minutes from our executive session last month, item 4B. We'll review this quickly and then... So now that everyone's reviewed the minutes, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the August 28th board executive minutes.
Thank you. Second, anybody?
Second.
Sure. Okay. Motion and second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay, minutes are approved. We'll move to item five. And after that, we'll try to take care of most of the people who are here on enforcement actions.
You can't do five till 9:30.
We can't do it till 9:30. Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome.
So let's do item 6A1 on the agenda. I believe someone's here on this case. This is case number HI-18038. Respondent is Robert Budenoff, home inspector. And this is in regards to a complaint that was received while responded at home inspection in Gilbert, Arizona in 2018. The investigative conclusion from the board was that it was only a de minimis violations of the Board Practice Act, and that staff recommendation is that a letter of concern be issued reminding respondent to report on the condition of bathroom cabinets and countertops and to renew his home inspection certification on time. So if you're here to speak on this case, would you please state your name for the board?
My name is Robert Budenoff, and I really have nothing to add.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Budenoff, for being here. Appreciate it. Is there any discussion on this item?
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion to issue a letter of concern. Budenoff, H118038.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second to issue a letter of concern. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, next.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Appreciate your time. We will handle item 6C3 since they're here as well. This is case number HI-18032. Respondent is David Peters, home inspector with Lighthouse Home Inspections. There was a complaint that the respondent failed to report on condition of an HVAC system, water supply piping, interior drain and waste system while doing an inspection in Phoenix in December of 2017. There was also an allegation that the respondent firm engaged in the practice of home inspection without firm registration with the board. There's the staff recommendation, which just for reference, I believe there are two consent agreements included in the packet. One is the board's proposed consent, and then, Ms. Laura, is there anything you want to say to that?
Yeah, I have an update. On the 19th, we had a settlement conference, so the second proposed consent agreement is a revised signed agreement with the changes of, we took out the peer reviews, and we, per respondent, we did a administrative penalty from $1,000 to $500, and he chose to sign that, and that's what's in front of you.
Thank you. Perfect. So just to summarize what the conclusions were, the respondent failed to conduct a home inspection in accordance with standards of professional practice, and that respondent firm did not have a current registration at the time. The staff recommendation in front of us right now is a letter of reprimand, state suspension and probation, remedial training, restitution of $275, $500 administrative penalty, and the cost of investigation to $563. So would you please identify yourself on the board, sir?
I'm David Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Is there anything you'd like to say?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the signed consent agreement signed by Mr. Peters on September 19th.
Just matter.
Second. Yeah, the one signed is the revised one.
The revised, the signed consent, yeah.
Second.
Okay, motion to second. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, Mr. Peters. Appreciate your time.
Wow.
Record base. A lot of the other people in the audience are here for items under 9. And I think we will take those after the enforcement cases, so just please bear with us for a little bit. We do have a Brad Cobb, item 7B. Sorry, I think you guys jump around everywhere. Applicant is Bradley Cobb. He is applying for a certification as a home inspector. Mr. Cobb had some, or disclosed some criminal history on his application and provided, the information on the case. So we have his application and it's in front of us to review whether to grant certification or not. So would you please state your name for the record?
My name is Bradley Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Cobb. Is there anything you'd like to say to the board as we consider whether to grant licensure?
No, sir. I think it's all in the application.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Cobb? Mr. Cobb, this happened in 2010? Is
yes,
that correct?
Sir.
Okay.
Since 2011 here.
Yeah, I think the sentencing was in 11.
Yes.
Correct?
Sir.
Okay.
Okay.
And have you had, you have not had any incidents or any other criminal history since then? Okay.
What's the Class D felony?
Mr. Donald, are you asking?
Scott.
Mr. Donald, or who?
Scott, Class D felony is toward the lower end of the felony, correct?
Yes. Yeah, Class D is as low as you can get unless it's a Class D, or, well, Class 6 is the lowest degree of felony, you know, unless it's an open-ended. Class D felony is that in Arizona?
Indiana.
It's Class D felony and Class B misdemeanor. I would assume it's on the low end of the felony scale, but we use a 1-6 in Arizona, so it's difficult to say. Because it's combined with a misdemeanor, I would assume that it's not a top level.
And speaking for myself, the police report was fairly, disturbing to me. It's definitely something that would concern me if somebody were to practice as a home inspector and go into people's homes. I do appreciate that Mr. Cobb, was forthcoming on the application. He also seemed forthcoming when the incident happened and has been clear of any issues for the last 8 years. So. But it certainly was not something insignificant.
You flew in?
Yes, sir.
For this?
Yes, sir, I did.
You've had no incidences since this, no, this time?
And the only other issue is he still has to register. He had to register for 10 years. So there's still
2 years left?
3 years left on that. Perception, I think, than anything else, but still, that's the only real reservation I have about it.
That he's currently registered?
If somebody called and inquired.
But I think that's, I guess that's sort of public disclosure, if anybody's going to use his services, but...
Yeah. It's the only reservation I have about the thing. And it's really nothing, it's just perception.
Right.
Of, if we grant licensure and that comes up, it's like, well, because we knew about it. I don't know, it's fine.
Well, he's been clean for 8 years, he's had a good track record. We're all in the business of giving second chances.
Yeah.
Here, so. But I understand your position.
Yeah.
Very clearly.
And this is a little different than when we have a petty theft charge or something like that. I mean.
Yeah.
And it's just because he's going to be he has to register.
What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, Andy. I move that we grant Mr. Cobb's application.
You're moving.
I'm moving.
We grant. Okay.
I'll second that.
I have a motion and a second. Any additional discussion before we vote on the motion? Okay. All in favor of the motion?
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
This motion passes. Mr. Cobb, congratulations and make good use of your new certification.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, usually they apologize profusely.
Yeah. The only thing I don't like.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's true.
Okay. Yeah. We still got time, yeah. So we'll start with cases 6B1.
Yeah, I know. We can set 1 and 2. Somebody want to call any one of those out?
Get out of here, sir.
Since we're signing.
I only had a question on 1.
Of course you did.
Okay. But let's do it quickly. 6B1. Matthew Wills, case number alarm 18009.
6B1.
This is about aiding and abetting the unlicensed practice of alarm system sales. This was a case where they sold an alarm and then the homeowner complained that the firm wasn't registered or that the controlling person wasn't registered later. Is that correct? Then we further dug into it. We found that the actual person who sold the alarm was not registered either.
And the alleger was also complaining that the person that sold the alarm was not registered as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Will. The my question was Willis registered or not registered? I was confused by that. It seemed like he called and we told him he or the alleger called and we said he wasn't, but he might have been under a different number?
Yes, it took a little digging to figure that one out.
Okay.
He provided the response that his firm and his personal registration was valid. However, the person that he allowed to sell or authorized to sell the alarm system, he assumed had completed his registration when he had not.
Okay, but we confirmed that he was registered as a controlling person. But we told the alleger that he wasn't.
Well, what happened was when he filed the complaint, it had lapsed in that after it had been installed and when the complaint came in. So
okay.
That brief time there, it did lapse.
Okay. And what I'm not trying to blame anybody. What I'm trying to figure out, was this an issue with our computer system? And if it was, just that we have to be really careful when people call and ask, you know, is this person current or not? I think we either say, you know, look on the website or be very careful and research the issue so we don't give people, you know. So, my point is, I don't know exactly what happened, but just want to make sure we're careful on that. So, this consent agreement is not for his practice. It's simply for aiding and abetting the practice by the person who installed the alarm. And it includes a letter of reprimand, a $500 penalty, and $168 in cost of investigation. Okay. Is there any discussion on this item or motions?
Mr. Chair, the question I have is, did the alarm system work?
Did it work?
Is it working? Is it?
I would assume so. I mean, the ledger never said it didn't work. He had issues with billing and the fact that the person that sold it to him was not registered.
Right. Yeah, the complaint didn't say anything about the alarm not working.
Yeah, I'm just surprised that a person who buys an alarm, say, issues with the billings, and he looks, is this guy registered? I mean, he seems like the last thing you'd do. Like he was trying to get the person. It
doesn't make any sense.
Well, yes, it does, because a lot of times these guys will go see that you have a ADT sign in your yard, go up, and a lot of times the scam they use is, hey, our company bought ADT, I need you to re-sign this contract.
Right.
You know, I don't know what happened in this case, but it happens.
Yeah.
You know, so it could be that, you know, and then they'll get billed from two different companies, and, you know, it's...
Didn't that happen to you?
Yeah, it might have been another company trying to sell him an alarm, telling him that his original company was out of business.
Yeah, that happens too.
It could have been, maybe he just wanted to get a credit on his, alarm bill, and, I don't know.
Regardless of why he messed him up, that's not really the point.
Right.
Really?
He's a controlling person, and he was having people selling alarms who are not registered
sell alarms. He's having employees underneath him selling alarms without being licensed. So I'll make a motion. Is there a motion? Have we had a motion?
There is no motion, Jason. We're waiting
for you. So I'll make a motion to accept signed consent agreement AL18009.
Second. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We'll go to 6B2. Case number HI19002. Jeffrey LaMatta, home inspector. This is regarding home inspection in Tolleson. This person, or this registrant, conducted an inspection while his certification was expired, was forthcoming about his mistake, and collaborated with the investigation. There were no real issues with the quality of the report. The consent agreement is a letter of reprimand, a $500 penalty, and $154 for cost of investigation. Any discussion or motions on this item?
Mr. Chair, I move to accept the consent agreement as signed.
Second that.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Boy, we're breezing through this today. We'll take 6C1. Case number P18071. This might take a few minutes.
Yeah.
The respondent is Rodolfo Chapa from Centrix Engineering. And the issue here, to summarize, is that this firm prepares forensic engineering reports for failures and other things. In this case, they prepared a report, one of numerous that they have prepared, I think, according to them as well. But the other concern that the board had was that they're using the name engineering, which might lead people to believe that they practice engineering. We had an EAC meet, and the conclusion of the EAC was that the respondent violated areas 32-145, and that they advertised or displayed the term engineering on letterhead and report to indicate they're qualified to practice a board-regulated profession. And also 32-141, and the respondent firm did the same thing without being registered with the board. Their recommendation was a consent agreement with assurance of discontinuance of practice, administrative penalty of $500, and cost of investigation of $590. Anything you want to add, Mr. Wallace, to this case?
Mr. Chapa told me he would be here. He disagreed with the
consent
allegation. He needed to be registered, or the board's opinion that he needed to be registered to do his forensic analysis work.
Did you repeat that, Mr. Will?
Mr. Chapa did not agree that he needed to be registered to do his forensic engineering work that he's been doing.
I can't say I disagree. It's like a appliance. People servicing.
It depends, I think.
Can we discuss that?
Yes, we're open to discussion at this point.
This is actually a niche area that's quite heavily populated in mechanical engineering. We have a lot of failure analysis.
Can you speak up so everybody can hear you, please? Yes. I can hear you, but I don't know people in the back.
We have quite a few failure analyses performed by professional mechanical engineers. Their reports are certified. They're submitted as legal documents for adjudication, if you would, civil court cases. What I see, and I agree with Neil, the work done by Centrix was extremely elementary. In my mind, it was empirical, experimental, and in fact, it didn't follow the normal course of failure modes investigation. The presumption on the part of the investigators was that this was an installation failure. The compression coupling had somehow been maligned and the gasket deformed and therefore the leak ensued. Well, that's interesting because it had been successfully in service for 6 years. So what apparently is missing here is that may have been a what we call a contributing factor, but not the primary cause. There could have been an assumption set of events. The house could have been controlled by a pressure regulator which failed. So there was a pressure surge 6 years after installation, so that the house water pressure increased and then caused the failure. We don't know that. It all depends upon the rigor and the education and the discipline of the analysts, the ones who are doing the studies. I mean, we've seen this even in my own field. So my point is that and, you know, if you had qualified forensic, you know, mechanical engineers or people with professional certification doing this, they might have gotten to a more fault tree diagram or a more thorough investigation. This apparently is being used for thousands and thousands of dollars worth of damage. All state insurance is involved,
right,
and there's claims and counterclaims.
So you're saying they might not have had the right
I'm saying they might not have had the right failure or the complete failure mode mechanism defined. It just seems to me that usually when an installation failure is the root cause, a hydro test of the system will immediately expose it. It will start dripping. You will leak. It'll once the system is put under its design conditions, temperature and pressure, what we normally do when we do modifications in the field that involve pressure retaining lines is we soak it for two hours. Just let it soak for 2 hours and go back out and inspect it and see whether or not there has been any ensuing deformation or damage. It generally handles, 99.9% of installation anomalies. I'm not saying it's comprehensive, but it's pretty darn good. For something to have been installed, and then as he says, these supply lines were, I'm reading right from his own report, the supply lines were in service for only approximately 6 years only, eliminating age and normal wear and tear as a possible cause of failure. Well, that tells me it also eliminates installation as it's a contributing cause, but it would likely lead me to believe there are other causes. I don't know enough about it. I'm just saying that the analysis approach was elemental. It was experimental, observational. There wasn't,
But it's being used to make, significant decisions.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So let me back up. Or go. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, later? The issue I have, I understand you have to a testing lab. And if they set up a thing or mocked it up or whatever and did the test and wrote, we tested it, we put it under this pressure, the leak occurred at this location, and just the facts. As a testing lab, you should just be doing facts. But they shouldn't be, as soon as they cross the line is when they started making conclusions. I think that jumps into the realm of engineering. If you're a testing lab, let's say you're testing concrete samples, and the testing lab breaks the concrete sample. They can say, we put it under this load, and it failed at this, and this
PSI.
Was the failure mode, and they write it up. But then they can't say, this concrete is bad, or, this is unserviceable, or this did not meet the specs, or none of that, because they're the testing lab. There has to be a delineation between testing, which, isn't regulated, and then drawing conclusions, which I think is the practice of engineering. Because, as Gene said, you have to have the education to understand, okay, well, maybe you did do a test, and maybe they did do a test, and they found out this, but it passed on to a mechanical engineer who asked the same questions you did. What was the pressure that went through it? Was there a pressure failure? Why did the pressure increase if this was really what the result was? So I think they kind of jumped the line from a testing lab to an engineering analysis person.
Right.
And having the name engineering in their... Right. In their title. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well,
the public's going to look at it and go, okay, they say we're so-and-so engineering.
Yeah.
What do you expect? I mean, and...
But let me back up a little bit, because I think there's background important to this. 8 months ago or whatever it was, we had a discussion about whether expert witnesses mm-hmm. and forensic experts needed to be registered in Arizona or not, right?
Yep.
And what we decided was that we decided that they needed to be registered with the board to practice in Arizona, and then we took that policy back in part because we thought that if it was a court case, it was up to the court to decide. Stop me whenever I say something wrong, Mr. Donald. It was up to the court to decide who was an expert in the eyes of the court. So we didn't say that you had to get registered or didn't have to get registered. We basically took no position, but forensics is a special case. So in this case, their website and everything says they do forensics. The question is then, are they practicing engineering, even though it's mostly forensics?
Well, I know that the EAC was split on this.
Right.
There were two members, so it was an indeterminate, two for and two against. In my mind, there is no ambiguity. I'm very biased. I clearly
don't
see...
Don't say you're biased.
Yeah.
You have an opinion.
I think that, when I went back to, AACR 432.21 and 32.101, engineering is the application of special knowledges. You need to have special knowledges in order to, perform these functions. this is not layman type action. I think what Jason was saying in terms of a laboratory setup and almost, you know, forgive me, but, you know, almost plumbing in nature, that I think would be more mechanistic. It's simply an observational experiment. You have the assembly, you look at it, you determine, you know, where there's damage, what is dented, what is frayed, you put it under a microscope. These kind of mechanics are laboratory type elements. They then become input to the engineers who then integrate that, you know, into what, like I said, a fall tree fragment or a storyline. I mean, just to be simplistic.
Yeah, but just as a hypothetical case, I mean, if they're doing this and this is going to a court case and it's signed by two guys who have engineering degrees, you know, the court's going to ask him, you know, are you qualified to prepare this? Is this your expert testimony? And they're going to say, yes, I am, yeah, da, 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 da. So at that point, the court's deciding whether they're experts or not. Are they practicing engineering then outside of that? And I guess, let me back up one more step. What I'm really trying to get at is, if we do tell Centrix Engineering that they are practicing engineering, we're also telling them to discontinue the practice. So we need to sort of try to spell out how they can continue to do things. I mean, we don't have to, but we should try, because I think it's tough to say, yes, you guys have a significant business here and we simply think you're practicing engineering, so can't do it anymore.
I would think for their own credentials, they'd want to have their own mechanical engineers on staff, and I would think council would be looking for those credentials as well. So if they're not there, then this should be forensic failure analysis, or Centrix forensic failure analysis. Just get rid of the report engineering. We've been pretty consistent.
Just get rid of the word engineering.
One of the last paragraphs in their conclusion is that it's based on a reasonable degree of engineering certainty, and that seems to be towing the line pretty closely.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think it's engineering work. My question is it, because it's done for court cases, is it under our purview?
I think those are two different questions.
Okay. Yes, I think it's engineering.
Yeah, well, that's the question I think we as a board are addressing. Because courts will allow individuals to testify as experts based on their education, training, and experience. And frankly, it doesn't have to be specific to their degree. Right. In other words, you may have a PE testify about something else based on their training and experience.
A crash reconstruction specialist, yeah. You know, testifying as...
I frankly think we need to take the fact that this is a court case, whether they're qualified to be an expert or not, off the table. I think the issue is, are they practicing engineering? And in my experience, this is the first time I've seen a failure analysis report done by a non-PE. So it kind of surprised me to see that.
Okay, so I get your point, Andy, but so next time somebody comes in who did precisely what I said, you know, a former police officer, a detective who used to evaluate crash, scenes,
yep.
And says that, you know, based on my analysis, the car was going 60 miles an hour, I wouldn't stop, prepares a report and submits it to the court, is he practicing engineering too then?
Well, but it depends on what his report says.
Right.
If his name of his company is ABC Crash Engineering, and his report says, I'm doing all this, and my conclusion is this, with engineering certainty, yes.
The name of the company is an issue, but whether your name of the company or not, if you're preparing that report, is that engineering or is it not engineering? You're basically using physics and other principles to determine that, you know, something happened pre or post crash.
Well, but those opinions are based on my experience as a police officer investigating accidents. It's not applying scientific. It's not applying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That, yeah. Well, the way you couched the preamble on that seemed to imply that he was using his police crash observational experiences, and that's completely different than engineering. Okay, an engineer would be applying scientific principles and practices as I say, practice special knowledges to this. It may sound fancy, but really, I mean, I've seen these, and it can get very fancy. I mean, you know, crack propagation analysis, plastic deformation, energy absorption. I mean, these are really
Gene, what about the guy who's registered in another state and prepares a expert witness report here in Arizona without registration in Arizona? Because we've had those come up as well.
I thought we determined that that was practicing engineering here.
And then we took it back. I mean, we issued a policy that said that was engineering and they needed to get registered, and issued a substantive policy, and a month and a half later we decided to rescind that policy. And I don't know, I mean, why did we rescind the policy? Melissa, can you guys help us understand why we rescinded the policy?
Because the AG's office thought that we were
overstepping.
Yes.
But with the present case, I see sort of two different potential areas here. The one is this specific situation, and then there's also sort of a parallel discussion of the general, in general, is this a violation? And it may be helpful for the present to kind of look back at the specific reports issued and the specific website of this guy to decide in this case if this particular one is a violation, rather than looking too broadly at the entire industry to decide if in general this type of work constitutes a violation. Because this report may constitute a violation, whereas were drafted differently, it may not. So the board may find that this is a violation, but in general in the industry it wouldn't be, or it may find there's no violation at all. But without opening it up to too broad, you know, of an analysis.
So Gene, if there wasn't forensic engineering involved, if this was your house, why wouldn't you just call a plumber? Have them fix it?
It's all a question of, you know, what prompted this, and I thought it was the litigation. I thought that there was...
Get the insurance company involved, big money starts involved, let's go hire somebody to do this when a plumber could have fixed this.
This is mechanistic. There's no, but the work that Centrix did, in my mind, was not engineering. It was mechanistic, observational, experimental. They just took the supply lines, the valve, and the coupling, they disassembled it, they put it under a magnifying glass, and they drew, you know, observational conclusions. No one put any, you know, X-ray fractography on it. Nobody sliced it and put it under a scanning electron microscope. There was no discussion of fatigue, of mechanical overstress. I mean, I could come up with a sundry set of reasons why a particular coupling could fail, but theirs was relatively elementary. It was just, you know, the gasket was ununiformly compressed and crushed, and therefore it leaked.
Yep.
Well, a plumber could have drawn that conclusion.
But this case aside, for the general public to look at their website, are they expecting that?
Well, that's the other part.
Yeah, see, there's...
That's the other part of this.
That's the other part of this.
Which I agree, engineering, use of engineering. So I agree with the findings.
Carmen, did you have something?
My question was the investigative conclusions focused on the letterhead and the website. So in your question about how to go forward, it's not shut down the business. It's, you know, switching your letterhead and your website so you're not misleading.
Put the name engineering out off.
Yeah.
Pat?
I can't remember the name of the case, but you had something similar, a contractor from California, producing, I think he was doing walkthrough inspections as an architect in Arizona, but he's not a registered. So essentially you had the same discussion what he was doing he could do as a contractor, but he couldn't say he was doing it as an architect because he's not registered as an architect here.
Yeah, and the part that I agree with is I'm not quite there in saying that the stuff that's done for the courts constitutes engineering, because that's for the courts in my mind. But not all the work that they do is for court cases. From what their letters said and everything, they do a lot of work for insurance industry, for adjusters, and for stuff like that. A lot of that doesn't end up in court, and there's no one to determine whether they're experts or not. So that should definitely be done by a registrant. So that part I agree with. Mr. Platt.
Chairman, that previous case was my case. It was about 6 months ago, and the board decided that the report that the guy did not reach a level of engineering, and so they unfounded that allegation. But his firm did have engineering in the title, and they directed him to take that out.
Yeah, and I think the conclusion we have right now is that both him individually, he can't refer to him as an engineer, and the firm can't be engineering.
Right.
There was no finding about the report itself being a violation.
Right.
So we need to decide, do we uphold the two violations? Do we add a third one? Do we not? And so I'll listen to what
you No, I think the assurance of discontinuance just to is
sufficient.
What Carl was saying about removing engineering, because if you go back and step back and say, okay, the public, and you can say an insurance company is the public as well, if you see this title and you're going through the phone book and you see this, and you call them, what do you expect them to get?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, there's no way, you know, it's not ambiguous at all. But if it said if their name was Centrix Testing Lab, then what do you expect them to get from that? Or Centrix Failure Analysis, what do you expect them to get from that? You know, I think it's very clear that any layperson, and, you know, insurance adjusters, I would consider lay people as well, or attorneys, or, you know, anything else in this case,
definitely
under
attorney.
First pass, you know, under the first pass, it would be, what are you expecting to get from this?
Yeah.
You might dwell a little bit deeper into it, but, you know, right off the top, what are you thinking? I mean, you know.
I just want to cross-examine it.
Exactly. Okay, so is anybody interested in making a motion at this point?
So yeah, I'll make a motion to offer the consent agreement, P18071, assurance of discontinuance, administrative penalty $500, cost of investigation $590, not signed within 30 days, proceed to Form 101.
And I'll second that.
Yeah.
Okay. Do we need to tell him to take engineering out, or is that obvious?
That's the part of discontinuance.
Yeah, I think that's the findings of fact is that by the name of his firm, he's advertising to practice engineering, so
right.
He should
staff,
take it out.
Staff will have that. It's written in the
consent
agreement. Okay. So let's vote on the motion unless anybody has something to add. All in favor of the motion?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Do we want to do the 5A cases, or did we need to state here that what we're waiting on? Or
well, we have Scott.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Wow.
He'll do.
Well, just
make Mr. Wilkham. We'll get by.
I didn't ask for the Solicitor General or the AG to be here to deciding whether to close it, not actually taking any action.
So would you, Patty or Melissa, want to give an overview of this four cases, just why they're in front of us? It's later on the agenda, but if you can, just for everybody's benefit, explain why you're bringing them up.
Sure. Many boards have, as part of their statute, that a license can't be canceled if there's a pending investigation or hearing. So somebody can't kind of avoid the investigation or hearing by simply not renewing their license. This board doesn't have that language, so these are four cases where the board voted them to formal hearing, but in the interim, their licenses have been canceled. So they essentially have no license for you to
take away
to hearing. If you close them, if they come back and they apply again, you can reopen the matter. But Scott can probably explain it better.
That's actually a very good explanation.
So would the vote be to administratively close them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And you'll see by the category of license that it's home inspectors whose licenses are good for just a year, and the controlling person was sent to formal hearing when their license was good for only 2 years. And then we have a civil engineer who's been pending hearing for a lot longer, and that's why. You know, our statutes and rules are older and haven't been reviewed as critically as some of the medical board statutes that Patty referenced earlier. And so we're seeing this now as our hearing list grows longer, that we are losing this jurisdiction because you know, the home inspector certificates were revoked because they lost financial assurance and they didn't renew. And the same for the controlling person and the civil engineer. They just didn't renew because they knew they were under investigation. So it's like a catch-22 here.
Well, and the big thing is, go back to protect the public.
Right.
These people cannot practice anymore, so
right.
In essence, the public's been protected. They just kind of self-revoke themselves.
Right, in that sense, I'm good with it. My question is, what happens when they reapply and want to get the license again? Do we have to grant and then start the process of going to hearing again, and they can practice in the meantime, or can we deny?
No, the board can deny. The board can take into consideration. Essentially, if somebody comes back to the board, take an example, Mr. Spiruza, I'm not sure why I chose him because it's the most difficult name to pronounce. But were he to come back, his case would immediately be available to the board to consider when deciding whether or not to grant a license, and it would be reopened. It's something he would have to deal with at that time then. So it doesn't matter if it's now or 25 years in the future. He would still have to deal with it if he ever wants to actually practice as a representative.
And that's why they're administratively closed, correct?
But they wouldn't deal with it until they get a license. I mean, if we deny, they don't have to deal with it because they don't have a license for us to take them to hearing. We would have to grant and then go to hearing.
Or just deny them flat.
Or deny. I mean, our options are deny or grant and go to hearing.
Right. But to protect the public, I mean, you know, I guess it would be up to them to decide, is it worth it?
Yeah.
To practice.
Right. And we still have the ability, if we find out that they're practicing without being registered, obviously to pursue our own internal investigation and then to ask the AG to go and get an injunction against continued practice. So administratively closing is a cleanup process for us, but, you know, the larger issue is something we're going to talk about later on the agenda. You know, do we want to fix our statutes to avoid this in the future.
And in your case, what you just said, if they were caught, if someone made a complaint against one of these guys practicing without, then this would, because it's administrative closed, would pop back up again.
Well, we would have a new action for...
Right, but then this would be part of the packet.
It could be.
For the problem.
Right, factually.
Okay.
Right, and at that point it would be unlicensed practice with this report and injunction. If they continued after that, then it would be a matter of proceeding for contempt of court.
Okay.
I have a minor editorial comment.
All right.
The last sentence in 5A1 makes, you know, logical English, and that the matter can be reopened in the event either, meaning either Mr. Shriver or Secure Link applied for certification. 5A2, 5A3, and 5A4, that's not a coherent conclusion. The sentence should just say, the matter can be reopened in the event,
Respondent applies.
Respondent applies.
Oh, because it says either.
Because it's not firm, it's just the individual.
Yeah. Just build the editorial.
Come on, Melissa.
I didn't say that.
I did.
Stam's not here, it's his fault.
Okay. I like that.
Okay, so I'll make a motion on this.
What's your motion, Jason?
So I'll make a motion to consent 5A, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and administrative close.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second to consent all items and with administrative closure of the cases. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Cases are closed. Okay. 6, going back up the agenda, 6C2, I think, is next.
6C2.
This is respondent is Tanner Jeffrey Hass, case number AL18010. This case is connected to the Willis case. Willis was the controlling person. Mr. Hass was the person who actually did the installation without license. The board's reviewed the case. And the recommendation is assurance of discontinuance, letter of reprimand, a $500 penalty, and $176 in investigative costs. Mr. Will, anything else we need to be aware of?
Mr. Haas is stopped communicating with us.
I noticed that.
Do we know, does Mr. Haas still work over at Protection Source?
No, he hasn't.
Okay.
So he stopped communicating, but you did you have a phone number? You talked to him at one point, so was it phone or?
Yeah, both phone and email. I finally got a phone number for him. He said he did start the paperwork, and he did, to get license. But he failed to provide, I believe it was proof of ID, something along those lines, and was ultimately closed for failing to provide the items needed. When I finally got a hold of him, he said he knew nothing about you know, any case or complaint against him, and I told him that's why I was calling. He gave me his current email, his current phone number. I sent him this consent agreement, and I haven't heard from Sam, and he has not returned my voicemails, he has not returned my emails.
Okay. Any suggestions in order to proceed? Just offer the consent?
So moved.
Okay.
I'll second that.
Not signed within 30 days.
If not signed in 30 days,
proceed formal hearing.
Go to hearing. Okay. So we have a motion to offer the consent or go to hearing if not signed in 30 days. And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. We'll move on to item 6D1 for the third month in a row.
God.
Case number HI-18033, respondent is Stephen Bartolome, home inspector. And just to go quickly, I mean, this was the individual that was observed on video looking through drawers and personal belongings during a home inspection, denied it, then when confronted with video, admitted it. We've offered him a consent agreement for voluntary revocate surrender, and he declined that, so we added a bunch of conditions for him to keep his license, and he had requests to change that as well. We made him one last offer where he would have to disclose to any of his customers that he had this case where he had been found to be looking through people's stuff. And now he's coming back to us. What is he asking exactly, Mr. Will?
I have no idea. The attorney will not return any contacts.
Okay.
Okay.
We're not happy with the consent agreement.
There's a decision that's already been made, I think. Right?
As a board, last month, yeah.
Yeah, if he doesn't sign by the end, maybe by the end of the day today, because it was the 25th, then it's going to proceed to formal hearing.
Right. Now, I guess a question I have for Scott is there a way for us to be able to suspend his license or his registration until such time that the hearing is completed? Because if the hearing takes a year, this guy's out there practicing, you know, he's already practiced for 3 months because we were, you know, trying to help him out. And, you know, let's say the hearing's another year out, this guy's out there practicing for a whole other year. Is there a way to suspend his license until such time it's over with?
Yes, there is. There would be a summary suspension where the board issues a suspension and then the matter has to proceed to a hearing for summary suspension very quickly. You don't have the normal lead time for I'd have to get a hearing set before within the next several weeks. For it. The issues I would see with that, the biggest issue I would see with that would be the argument, and because this was a discussion that was brought up originally with Mr. Bartolome, when the board first, I think, looked at this situation. The argument from his attorney at this point is going to be the board didn't vote it to summary suspension when it first became aware and first saw the video. So why the board would now think it was a summary suspension as opposed to at that point. So he would have an argument that way, that the board's inaction initially on summary suspension indicates it really doesn't rise to that level, and there may be a retributive aspect of it. I'm not saying that's a winning argument on his end, but that would certainly an argument he would raise.
What's the likely timing for a formal hearing? How far out?
For this matter, considering how cut and dry this is, quite frankly, I would expect the complaint to be ready within the next 14 days at the latest. So it's a matter of getting a date with... Actually, as a matter of fact, this is a case that I would expect to bring to the board as opposed to OWA. If it were a summary suspension, we'd have to go up to OWA, but this is a case I'd probably try to the board. I would expect that we'd probably not be able to go for the next board meeting because of necessary timing for service, but it would be the subsequent board meeting, so 60 days from today.
November board meeting.
We don't have a November board meeting scheduled. We have December, which is normally when we do our celebratory luncheon. This could be placed on that agenda, but given that we don't have a November board meeting, it may be a lengthier agenda.
Sure. I got a question?
Yes, sir.
There's a note here in this report on August the 16th. Respondent called and stated he could not comply with a third-party observer. He requested that he be permitted to sign the original consent agreement to voluntarily surrender his license. Can we go back to that?
Yes, but he had that offer given last month and that he wants to continue to be on his license.
Okay, so he's changed his mind since?
Yes.
Okay.
That was before the previous board meeting, I think.
Yeah.
So...
I agree with Andy. I mean, we made this decision last month, so he has till the end of business today to sign it, or it automatically goes to hearing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we really don't have to do anything at this point in time.
Sure.
Not unless we want to summarily suspend.
Yeah, but I think that's going to end up being a problem.
Yeah.
So, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think we have, again, our business is to protect the public.
And additionally, it hasn't actually been agendized for potential summary suspension at this point.
Oh.
If the board goes to get that route, we would have to set it for the next agenda and then potentially move to summary suspension at that point, but that would then push back proceeding with a complaint notice of hearing.
To January.
Yeah, that would actually potentially pull out
right.
The...
problem is we're not going to get to it until December,
it
right?
You're funny.
Mr. Donald, what are the normal notices for this? I mean, is there any way to get in October?
Well, quite frankly, the board could also, if you wanted to go that, if the board wanted to consider a summary suspension, what we could always do is set a telephonic board meeting. We would need to have an agenda 24 hours before the board meeting, but we certainly could set an interim board meeting to consider that one aspect of things. Alternately, I could try the case at OWA as opposed to for the board and setting it at OWA. It would be set for hearing prior to December. It would be set for an earlier hearing than that. The judge would then have 20 days to render a decision. That decision would come back to the board, and the board would consider whether to accept, modify, or reject that decision at the next board meeting.
Well, another option could be, I mean, we could have a November board meeting and have one item on the agenda.
Because
all we have to do is post the agenda, or post that there's a meeting, what?
24 hours in advance.
Yeah. So we could have it, or have a November board meeting that has one item on it.
Yeah, you could have a meeting.
Could we call in for that?
Or could we do our October meeting on October 30th? I mean, and then, you know, get all our notices out this week and give us the 30 days?
We could change.
Good job, Steve. Well, we could do the first week. I mean, you know, it would just be a, you know, yes, we'd have to come in, but it would just be a quick...
We can do it over the phone, too.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, ASBOG is on the 30th of October.
Yes, but it would be tough to do a hearing over the phone.
True.
We need a quorum.
So the way I see it, there is a benefit to bringing the case before the board for hearing because we make the decision that much more quickly than, you know, allowing the ALJ the 20 days to get it to us. It really isn't an issue of great confusion that would require an ALJ, but at the same point, it gives Mr. Bartolomei the opportunity to present his evidence in what he might consider an unbiased forum. So,
and we'd be subpoenaing the homeowner and the realtor and everyone else that's involved with it.
For the ALJ.
Right, and
for the ALJ. No, we're here for the board.
Oh, and here. I mean, it would be, you know, the same witnesses and evidence regardless of the location. So I guess it's up to you. Do you want to schedule a hearing on a November agenda?
Fine. We'll drive.
Yeah.
4 hours for Jason. 6 hours for you.
Don't bother me.
Well, thanks for the support.
Yeah.
Come on, Jason.
You call in, man.
Okay. So I think we don't have to take action today. The offer that we made was that he could sign it by the end of the day. And if he didn't, we would forward it to hearing. I think today we're just providing additional direction to staff that we want to bring this to the board if he doesn't sign it at the earliest possible time. Yeah, good.
Yep. And then, you know, Scott will get right on writing the complaint notice of hearing, and we can, how about if we get a sense from you before the meeting ends today what your November calendars are like, so we can establish a potential date.
Now, once this day, once the day expires and it automatically gets forwarded to hearing, and he's made aware of that, he can't come back and say, oh, I want to sign it now, or I want to...
Oh, he could.
Could he?
Yeah.
He so could say that. We could just tell him no.
Unless he wants to sign voluntarily, sir.
Right. Voluntarily.
Yeah.
Procedurally, at any point after the filing of the complaint notice of hearing, and within a certain number of days of the actual hearing, a respondent can request a settlement conference. And statutorily, they have a right to one. And if we arrive at a settlement, a potential settlement, that would need to be brought to the board to decide whether to accept or reject. So that could potentially result in a continuance of the hearing date. Or it could simply be set for the board to consider the day of the hearing. And the board could determine to reject the settlement and or the hearing. It depends on what settlement.
But would it have to be a signed consent agreement that he's submitting? So he can't just say, make a change, have it come back. So we're not on this endless merry-go-round of, you know, he says one thing, he's not signing it, just like right. He's been done
right.
For the last 2 months.
Right.
He doesn't like either offer, though. He doesn't want to voluntarily surrender. He doesn't want the third.
Well, go to a hearing.
Right.
Well, legally, what I would suggest in a certain circumstance would be to agendize it for potential entry into a consent agreement or alternatively a hearing on the merits.
Okay.
That way the board could, you know, right up until the second of the hearing, decide whether or not to accept any
right.
Consent.
Okay. So really, there's no action for us right now, except for at the end we'll have to decide on our date.
In November.
November.
Beginning of November sometime.
13th, possibly.
Works for me.
Works for me.
November
13th. Mm-hmm. What time? Sorry. Can we sleep?
Be here by then?
Can we sleep in?
You're not here?
No, I'm here. I'm just, okay. I'll be gone from the board, I think.
There you are.
Oh.
I have a trial that day, but I'm the only one.
It's a hearing. We need you. Yeah. And your trial will get postponed anyway.
In May.
Yeah, any time that week is good for me.
Is the trial...
It's a one day.
Oh, okay.
15 is fine.
15? Yeah. Oh, it doesn't have to be a Tuesday.
No.
Okay.
Shut me, I guess it's old school here.
That's what I have, left in my car, that's what I do.
How about, could we do the 8th? Is that enough time?
No, I'm not here on the 8th.
No.
Okay.
We'll be drawing pictures frantically in November.
Yeah.
20th?
20th?
Is that too close to...
I'm here on the 20th.
They're joining for me.
20th was right before Thanksgiving.
I can't do it.
Where are you going?
I'm out. Okay, yeah.
Well?
Darn.
How about the 19th?
That would work. Monday would work.
19th.
19th. Works.
19th? Okay. Alejandro?
Yeah, I'm good.
And if we get, if we happen to get a signed consent agreement, we could do a telephonic one for that then.
Yes.
I would assume they would want to be okay with that. It's hard to do a hearing over the phone, but if it's just, we have a signed consent agreement, and it's all the things that we already agreed to, and he signed it, we could just all call in and vote on it.
Vote, yeah.
Yep, sure.
9:00, or?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yep.
10, maybe?
It's fine, 10. Yeah.
9 is fine.
It just depends.
Does it block it out?
I do it for life.
It'd probably be an hour, would be my guess.
3 days.
7:00.
With no lunch.
At least two hours.
Okay.
These gentlemen are optimistic that it will only be...
I don't even think it's going to go to...
Just try to block it out.
So 19th?
The 19th, that Monday. 9.
9:00?
9:00.
9?
Oh, let me put it in my computer.
Indoctrination by fire calling, you're going to learn everything before the end of the year.
You can listen to the audio. So let me put this on my calendar. Sorry, one second.
Yep, all squared away.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll move on, thank you, Mr. Wall. Item 7A is next. And Mr. Winter, I believe we were going to call this respondent?
Which one?
This is Kyle Marquis. Told you, architects.
He's an architect, thank God.
Marquis is an engineer. Oh, my God, this is...
He's an architect.
We know you're not like that, Neil.
No.
Right?
God, this is just awkward. Don't answer, don't answer.
We can try again. Right, he failed to disclose, that's what bothers me. No voicemail?
It's done. Your one chance.
If there's...
This one?
I don't know if he has a voicemail message.
Apparently, he doesn't have a voicemail, so do we want to give him 20 minutes to drive him again after we do the other items, or...
That's certainly up to you.
Or do we want to just move on and do his case?
No.
Well, if there's no consensus, I'm inclined to try him again in a little bit. Okay, so we'll move to 8. So, yeah, item 8A1 is the cancellation of registrations.
Carmen, you need to check, see if you're on here.
I think I'm good.
You're sure?
I don't know.
We like sneaking Neil's name in there sometimes.
I don't know.
Just
oh, wait a second.
You never know, Carmen.
I didn't know that part.
I did see Neil's renewal, and he signed it in an unauthorized color. We were going to give him a product. It was like red or
yeah,
something.
You don't need
change the rules.
Yeah. But Rob talked me out of it.
Open like, a case against
yeah.
him.
Like,
formal hearing.
That this color of signature is acceptable, but...
I'll always sign it red. I need to change the laws.
Well, I got to check this.
So why don't you make sure your name's not on it? Do I have, is there a motion?
I'll tell you okay.
Mr. Chair, I move to...
They're all alarm agents except one,
except
huh?
Item 8A, cancel
one.
Registrations.
Okay.
Steven? Second?
Okay, so we have a motion and a second to cancel the registrations that have been expired a full year. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, then 8A2 is for information only. These are the certifications that the board staff has granted over the last month.
These are new. Say, Melissa, start sending her the applications, not me.
You're still on the board. Yeah. You think you're amazing.
Yeah.
Lighten my load.
9A.
Congratulations on all those.
Okay. 9A, possible legislation to amend ARS 127C regarding cancellation of registration. Patty, you alluded to this earlier. Do you want to, I mean, this is about adding a statute that would basically not allow registrations to expire until we deal with the hearing or whatever case is pending.
And that's essentially it. I provided you with some example language that other agencies use, and you know, maybe Scott can provide you better guidance on whether or not it's...
Well, it depends on whether the board wants to retain jurisdiction indefinitely. That's really what it ultimately comes down to. The current mechanism has people fall off, and then you know, they're unable to practice. If they try to come back, the board is able to address it at that point. It doesn't go away for them. This would be to statutorily change it so the board would retain jurisdiction more or less indefinitely. They would not be able to be revoked or anything like that until such time as the board completed the disciplinary action. The board would have to come up with the statute, and they would have to also cross-reference it with the rest of their statutory scheme. But,
I guess the one thing in terms of public safety is if somebody just, they're going to go to here and get revoked, they just get canceled, they could go to another state, and that state will never know that there was something that happened in the state that rose to that level.
So there really is a sort of a balance in interests for the board. On the one hand, it does get people off the books in certain situations, but on the other hand, it doesn't provide public notice of why, necessarily. And because of the nature of confidentiality statutes, people won't be able to get information about that under certain circumstances unless the board retains jurisdiction and proceeds all the way through the
This could also be something we flesh out a bit at the L&R committee, too, to see, you know, how some stakeholders feel about it, how the L&R committee feels about it. I agree with Patty and Scott that it is a public protection notification issue. My concern is the timing. I think our push this coming legislative session should be for licensure by endorsement, and I don't want to add anything additional that might distract the legislature from what we're trying to do with that proposed legislation. So I do think it's worthwhile and that we should look at it. My concern is the timing at this point.
Well, and one issue I see, I mean, I could see if it was, you know, something that was so egregious that revocation was the option. But some of these, you know, these home inspector ones were just
financial assurances.
Things, financial assurance, and, you know, even the complaints against them, you know. So, but would, I guess you could write it somehow where, I don't know, where it would have to be an egregious thing or else it could be closed out. Because we don't want, like these home inspectors, sometimes you can't even find them after, you know, a couple of years. We could have something that stays on the books forever, you know, that could never get, you know, wiped off. But if we have a statute that says you can't, that's the only concern I have.
Well, and I think, you know, what this illustrates is the fact that the AG's office needs more resources to be able to prosecute all reporting hearings timely. And I've been talking with other executive directors about, they have the same concern. So we're talking about writing a joint letter to the AG saying, you know, ask for more general fund money, let us supplement with our ISAs for attorneys to prosecute our files, you know, our cases. Because this board is moving their investigations very timely, but because of the resources issue at the AG, Scott's not able to get to our formal hearings as timely as we would like. And now we've seen, you know, four of our cases fall off because although we had jurisdiction when it went to formal hearing, now we don't because our statute is older. So, you know, this is something we need to address.
So, I mean, I agree with the benefit of having a statute. I also think it's problematic, you know, just the effort to get it through might distract from more important stuff. But I don't know, what's your recommendation, Patty and Melissa? What would you do?
Since we have a sponsor this year, we could ask. I guess that's my one thing, is next year we may not have a sponsor. So we could ask if you'd be willing to sponsor a separate bill, and you could say no. Or we could just be happy he's willing to sponsor the one bill and let it go. I mean, you know, in the end, at least, if, you know, they do get canceled, they can't be out for advocacy. It's just, you know, do they continue to be a public threat elsewhere?
And this is why it's on the agenda, because although I agree with Patty, I don't want to pursue it this legislative session.
Yeah, I think it'd be problematic to say, hey, now that you're helping us with this, help us do this other thing that looks very different. I don't know, maybe I might suggest that we have a to-do list of things we want to change in the rules and statutes and keep this on the list. I like the language you guys proposed, so I think we could even put it with that language and just next time we're doing a review, we include that. But as a standalone thing, it seems like a lot of effort and, you know, concern over one item.
Maybe it should go to L&R and they can look at it. I'd like them to look at something where it's not just black and white, you know, that the board has an option of administering closed or leave open something. I'm just afraid if we have to keep them open, there will be, we'll have someone over there forever because we won't be able to find these people or...
We can.
And that looks bad, you know, when you go to, you know, governor review and stuff, that we have all these cases that are, I mean, we can end up with a huge backlog of cases, mm-hmm. and like, why can't we solve these when we can't find these people? Mm-hmm. And we can't close them.
Well, and actually, Nicolesco would have come back to you to close anyway if he hadn't been canceled, because we can't find him.
Right.
So we would have done the same thing. We would have brought him back to you, closed him, and then he reappears.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
But it can wait.
Yeah, L&R can take a look at it and play around with it a little bit.
Well, we're collecting an interesting list of topics for the next L&R committee, so I think this is definitely worthwhile to discuss, and you'll hear more about it, I'm sure, in upcoming meetings.
Okay. So, just you don't need action, just to send it to L&R, right?
That's fine.
Okay. Let's move to 9B. This is the petition to amend R43102-2, the definition of peril inspector. So, hopefully everybody got a chance to read the packet or listen to the discussion at the home inspector committee on this item. I believe there's several people here to talk about it. Is Mr. Leeds, Mr. Smith, Dimmitt. Thank you. I mean, if there's room up there at the table, you're welcome to join us for the conversation. This might take a few minutes. But you don't have to. You can stay back there. Up to you. You can come up to the table or you can stay back. Whatever you prefer. But there's room, I think, in there. Melissa, do you want to open it up? Or?
Sure. I think that the cover sheet pretty much explains why we're here. This statute became effective August 2nd, and what it does is it allows an aggrieved party to a new rule to come forward and explain to the board why the new rule places a hardship basically on their ability to practice. Although this issue doesn't really place a hardship on the issue of practice for Mr. Smith, he owns a school that trains home inspectors, and his concern is that the new rule now requires that the folks he hires to take the new candidates around to do their parallel inspections requires that they have 5 years of experience. And currently, Mr. Smith, not all of your employees have 5 years.
Yeah, I have 6 people, 2 comply, 4 don't.
Okay. And this issue was discussed at the home inspector meeting just a few weeks ago, which is why Mr. Leeds is here, because it was a pretty robust discussion about this. Apparently, Mr. Smith didn't understand the rules process where we allow for public comment about proposed changes to the rules, which is what happened in this case. The parallel inspector definition in our rules changed, also effective in early August, to now require the 5 years of experience for those teaching candidates how to do parallel inspections. Before, that 5-year requirement was not in there. And it was discussed for several years while the rules were pending, and it came before the board and it went to GIRC and all of the rest. And it's my understanding, and Mr. Leeds can certainly give you more information, the National Association standard is 5 years, which is where the committee came up with that number. And that's because there were all kinds of different homes and situations in those homes that after a 5-year period, a certified home inspector should have been able to see and pass that experience on to someone they're helping train. So in any case, that's the background. That's my understanding. And obviously, the gentlemen are here and can give you more information and answer questions.
Okay. Mr. Smith, do you want to say anything?
I would. I've been a home inspector for over 15 years. I started my school after managing Kaplan Professional School. They closed, and then I started inspection training in Arizona in 2010. We've trained over 300 inspectors for the state. I set up my business to comply with the requirements that the BTR had. There was no limitation on length of service or length of having a license and how many inspections. Most of my inspectors are also instructors at my school, so their education level is to a high standard. I've trained them all. I'm a professional pilot as well, so I know the profession. I know how important it is to have good training. I go through training every 9 months. Resimulator, the simulator ride, all that stuff. So I hold the same kind of standard to my instructors. They teach the class, they're aware of all the new stuff, and they do a great job. And none of my instructors or inspectors have had any violations. This new procedure or this new rule is really, it's going to limit the business that I've established. I mean, I set this up, I've got guys working for me, their income is going to be reduced dramatically if they can't be parallel. And it's a disservice to the public as well for the guys that are trying to do their training. They're going to be limited to just a few companies that can do it. Price will go up. I offer a reasonable rate, $3,900 to get your full inspector's license. That includes the parallels and then the classroom training as well. So.
Thank you. Does anybody on the board have any comment or questions?
Mr. Chairman, is the point 5 years versus how many inspections you've done? I mean, 5 years seems to be arbitrary versus how many you've done.
Yeah.
I would think more inspections is more important than time.
Well, I agree. An arbitrary number of 5 years doesn't mean you're going to be a good instructor. I mean, that's the whole point here. Just because you've got 250 inspections and 5 years, it doesn't make you a good instructor. And that's what I think we ought to all be looking for. My school is a post-secondary certified school. I have certain restrictions with them. I go through an annual application renewal. I'm audited. Classrooms looked at. So just having, just by simply stating 5 years, 250, doesn't really mean that individual has continuing education classes, because the DTR doesn't require that. My guys are constantly educated, always updated on new stuff. So I just think that's a valid point that you made.
Good. Mr. Leeds, Andy, go ahead. Did you
I was going to ask Peter.
We have another gentleman.
Okay.
But yeah. you said that there's two other companies that offer the same training that you do?
My company, Inspection Training of Arizona, is the only school in the Valley that offers the parallels as well. That's tied to it. The other ones are deferring the parallels to inspection companies.
Okay. So wouldn't they have the problem with the 5 years also?
Well, the schools aren't involved in it because they defer it out. So the schools aren't, there's no question. I mean, there is no question there. Because they're deferring it out to home inspectors.
Right. What it would require of the applicant is to find somebody with 5 years of experience.
Yeah. So I'd like to hear the committee's point of view on this. I mean, I know we heard the discussion, but if you guys can summarize, or if you've had any further thoughts since your meeting. Mr. Leeds, or?
My name is Peter Leeds. I've been with the Home Inspectors Rules and Standards Committee and the Board of Technical Registration for 18 years since its conception. For the first 2 years, we grandfathered and created the program and required 30 parallel inspections and 100 examples from the applicants to grandfather. 2 years later, and for the last 16 years, we've been requiring home inspectors to take the national exam, which our committee has had major input in, and to take 80, which is now 84 hours of classroom training, which these gentlemen do an excellent job at, and 30 parallel inspections. 30 parallel inspections was simply to get them familiar with the different types of systems, the different types of houses, and the different types of problems that they're going to run into over a wide spectrum of ages and different construction methods. Very simple. We toyed in the first 2 years with requiring 100 inspections. We actually had 100 inspections as our first rule, but then we were made aware that there are people living in the state of Arizona, because we do certify state home inspectors throughout the state, that it would make it very hard for them to get 100 inspections in a timely manner. We dropped it down to 30. 30 is the number. In order to get on the Rules and Standards Committee, the standard is 250 paid inspections, 5 years in the business, clean with the board for 3 years, and then we'll consider you to get on the Rules and Standards Committee. To get on an enforcement advisory committee, we don't require as much. However, for the last 16 years, we have found these results. home inspectors are 9% of the registrants in the state, everybody. We constitute almost 25% of the complaints, okay? What we're finding is many of the allegations against home inspectors are not substantiated simply because the people who are making the allegations don't understand the job, don't understand the service, okay? However, those same complaints will still go to an enforcement advisory committee meeting simply because the home inspector doesn't have a right of report and his report is not meeting the standards. And to back up just a step, if in fact the home inspector knew how to write that report, he may not have had that complaint to begin with, okay, whether it be substantiated or not. So we have found that our committee, the Rules and Standards Committee for Home Inspectors, our job is to protect the general public. Our job is to look at these numbers and determine the best method of correction, best method to make this work. Mr. Smith and this other gentleman here, although I haven't heard what his point is, but Mr. Smith is contending that 4 out of 6 of his home inspectors don't meet the standard that the rule that we just created. The rule that we put together is not a major burden on anyone, but it will be a major burden on every home inspector doing parallel inspections today. Okay? When we get an application from a home inspector, all right, he has to show 30 parallel inspections, all of them certified by a certain home inspector, and he gives us his number. The numbers on the parallel inspections that we're getting are very high numbers. We started with 38, okay, 3,800. Actually, I'm the first one in Maricopa County, so it's 38044, okay? Then, now we're looking at numbers that are starting with 50, all right? These guys have not had enough experience to train home inspectors in the field. This is our contention. We sympathize with Mr. Smith's 4 other inspectors who don't meet the qualifications, but we also know that we don't write rules for individuals, we write rules for the entire state. So we have many home inspectors out there that are getting their license today and going into business and teaching other people how to write reports tomorrow and putting the onus that they're being paid for on the Enforcement Advisory Committee members to actually do the training. So these gentlemen will get paid to do the training, and the Enforcement Advisory Committee members are volunteers who sit down, have to go through these reports, send them back, take them in again, send them back again, take them in again, send them back again until they meet the standard. The Enforcement Advisory Committee's job is not to do that, okay? We have talked. This gentleman and I have talked on the side saying, well, maybe we can work with what we call a responsible managing employee for the schools. Maybe we can work with a responsible managing officer for companies that will take the reports, review them, and put their name on it. However, I was informed at our last meeting that that won't fly based upon simply by our AAG, Scott McDonald, that the definition will not allow. These guys that go out with these gentlemen and ladies to do home inspections have to be certified with the state and meet the criteria. Now, we set the criteria simply for the safety of the general public. We don't want our Enforcement Advisory Committee members to fall off the wagon simply because we're overloading them with the work that other people are being paid for. So the Rules and Standards Committee, who I'm here to represent, on this issue, our recommendation stands at 250 home inspections paid, at 30 parallel inspections to be clean with the board for 3 years, okay, and not to just get a license and turn yourself out as a teacher. I just want to say in conclusion that these schools are doing a wonderful job with teaching. Teaching is one leg of our three-legged stool. We have a national exam, we have teaching 84 hours, which is wonderful, and then we have our parallel inspections, which you do not need to have a school to do. So we have many home inspectors out there that need to be reined in, and our best way of reining it in is 250 home inspections, 30 parallels.
to get on the ASHI committees or any other associations, rather, that this is the requirement to become fully vested. To get on our Rules and Standards Committee is fully vested. So these numbers were not just pulled out of the air. These numbers are standards in different places, and we have debated them for 18 years.
Thank you. Let me hear from the last gentleman first, and then sure. Back to you.
My situation is a little different. I don't run a school. I run a business. And my business is in a rural area. And from, so I train my own people. No, I've only been registered about 3.5 years, but I have over 1,600 inspections under my belt. I guess when I first read the 5 years or 250, that's one inspection a week for 5 years. That I would rather have somebody who's had over 1,000 inspections teaching me than somebody that's only had 250, but they've been in business for 5 years. And my hardship is, it's hard enough to find people to hire. We all know that. And for me to, at this point now, for me to hire anybody, because I'm in such a rural area, there's only, I think, 18 registered home inspectors in my county. Nobody wants to train their competition. So I would have to send somebody down here. I had to come down here to get to do my parallels and everything. I spent $4,000 to come down here for 2 weeks and do my parallel. I cannot ask an employee to spend $4,000 to come down here to do parallels. That's where I stand. I don't know if there's an exemption, a variance, something. Because basically, you've stunted the growth of my business.
If I may interject, this problem has been with us since the beginning as well. And this is why we actually went with 30 parallel inspections, to make it a little bit easier for the team. We knew at the time they would have to come to a big metropolitan area to get certified. We want to remember that we're certifying home inspectors for the entire state, and therefore changing the rules for different areas. I don't believe that it would be wise to give a license just for Apache Junction or to give a license for Preston or something else like that. We certify in the state. If it's a burden for these gentlemen to have to come to the city to do this, $4,000 was actually a bargain. We figured it would probably cost them more like $6,000 to get these parallel inspections done.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. So we'll hear from Mr. Smith, because I think you have something else to say. Then I'd like to really have some board discussion. We might have questions for you, but I think you already made your opening statements. Melissa, do you have something for Mr. Smith?
I have something for the board. After the committee meeting, I went back and asked staff to do some statistical research for me, because I thought that would be an interesting consideration for the board. In fact, the home inspectors at 844 registrants make up 3% of our licensed population, and they actually take up 34% of our enforcement actions for the reasons Mr. Leeds explained, that a lot of the report writing is what is problematic. But interestingly enough, when I talked to Rob about how long it takes to get home inspectors license, what he said was the one report that they have to submit for review is just one of those 30 reports that are all supposed to meet the standards, and staff sends those back almost half the time. So 45% of the home inspection reports we receive to complete an application for certification need to be redone, because the home inspector committee members we use to evaluate applications don't feel that they meet the standards. So I think that's part of the consideration for why the rule became the way it is now.
Okay, Melissa, since you're into statistics.
I'm not really, but just for you, I did it.
How many of the 844 registrants who are active have 5 years of experience, have been registered 5 years?
I don't know.
Actually, okay. Rob put that together for me. I thought I gave it to you. Maybe I didn't. I'll go get it for you.
Thank you. I think that's important. So, thank you, Patty. So, Mr. Smith, did you want to add something?
Yeah. I think Peter really summed it up. Education, and just like you guys know, education is the key thing. 50% of the training is done in classroom. The other 50% is out in the field. I proposed this before several years ago. Why not have the parallel inspector certified as well. Now you're going to increase the level of education, and it just doesn't make sense to have half the training done in class, and the other half can go with whoever. If you could put a licensing and procedures and standards that an inspector has to follow, a mentor, the education value would be a lot greater. It would be a lot greater.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And just to comment on that point, I want to open it up for board discussion, but one, I appreciate your idea. I'm concerned that adding another level of certification might actually exacerbate the issues in the rural areas to find somebody to be a parallel inspector. It also seems like we're adding barriers to entry into the profession, which our legislature is very concerned about. So I'm not sure I'm there yet, but I appreciate the idea.
One more thing, it's very common when new procedures are put in place or rules to grandfather. That's one of the things that I would like to ask the board to consider is a grandfather clause. And just to let you know, all of my inspectors, I mean, the ones that don't have 5 years have 500 inspections. I mean, they've done hundreds of parallels.
So all six of your inspectors have over 250 inspections?
Say that again.
All of your six trainers or parallels have more than 250 paid inspections?
Five have more than 250. One doesn't. However, that person has written over 150 inspection reports for another inspector that's in the team, so they can learn the whole thing. So the value there is a lot better if I'm able to write those reports. So,
thank you. So I'd like to have some board discussion. Does anybody have anything?
Did I hear that on a parallel inspection that the trainee who's going out with that person isn't registered or licensed?
No, they have to be. Actively practicing
it.
Yeah. Well, they're licensed. It's just you could go get your license and the next day be out there. I mean, the old rule.
With the old rule, yeah.
The old rule was you could get your license and the next day be out there being a trainer.
Yeah.
You know, so you have your license one day. And that was kind of, you know, the issue. It's, you know, how are you performing, you know, proper parallel inspections if you've only had your license for one day.
Okay.
So that was kind of, that's kind of the whole, kind of about the whole crux of this thing.
Yep. Makes sense.
I had a question for Melissa in terms of framework. I mean, have we actually gotten a request to relook at the rule? Because if, you know, just to remind everybody, there's a new statute that passed this year that if somebody contests the rule as being overly burdensome, we as an agency have, I think, two avenues. I mean, one is to, you know, reject the request and we need to provide an explanation of why we think it's not overly burdensome. Or within 60 days, we have to start the rulemaking process to revise our rules. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Have we gotten that request to look at the rule?
We are considering Mr. Smith's written request as complying with the statute. We haven't had time to come up with an official form for that.
Okay.
And so, yes.
That's fair enough. But just to frame the discussion, we really have two options here. We either, you know, look at modifying our rules, or if we decide we don't want to modify our rules, we have to provide a justification why we
right.
think our current rules make sense.
Correct.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, to be deemed a parallel inspector, that's a level above just a certified home inspector. So a certified home inspector meets the 84 hours of education,
the 30
parallel inspections, plus 100, does he also have to have? No.
No, it's just 30 parallels, 84 hours, and the exam.
And that's it.
That's... Now, the next step is if you want to sort of train others and be the parallel inspector, which is what's defined in our rule, then you have to have had, you have to have done 250 paid inspections yourself and have been licensed for 5 years.
And I guess the end is what is kind of a linchpin here.
That's one of the linchpins, correct.
Because it appears as if, and it's been brought out, time in service does not necessarily translate into any number of meaningful inspections. I mean, you could do
one a year for five years.
And what does five? What is the value added? I'm trying, you know, as a measure of merit, what is the value added of the 5 years?
So, I mean, I heard the discussion from the committee, and the discussion was that over a longer period of time, you might see different type of structures, you might practice in different areas of the state, which gives you a broader view of things. But I'll be honest, I'm skeptic of that. I think just having 5 years, or somebody who does 250 in 5 years, might not be any better than somebody who got 250 inspections in 2 years. The houses that you get are sort of a...
Well, making it parallel to an engineering applicant for licensure, and we need 4 years of qualifying experience. When I look at the experience record, if he's done the exact same thing for over and over again for 4 years, it's not... It doesn't show diversity of application and of experience. In other words, the experience should show breadth and depth of development over a four-year period. So you could do 6 months of experience, 16 times and come up with 4 years of...
As the committee said, they could inspect the same house 250 times.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is this is an honor system. I mean, they basically signed an affidavit, Mr. Leeds. Is that correct? That says I've done 250 inspections?
That is true.
Okay.
They don't have a choice on what houses are going to. Just the luck of the draw. With the engineering, if you own a firm, it's up to me to provide that breadth of experience to the young professional. Home inspectors don't have that, latitude.
What Patty provided, 35 to 40% of payroll inspections are done by inspector who does not qualify under the new laws. So 35 to 40% of the payroll inspectors would not be able to do them anymore. 8 to 10% are people of the payroll inspectors have less than 1 year of experience. But we don't know exactly how many of our registrants have 5 years, right? Have been registered for 5 years. I don't think.
But it's just 45 to 50% not qualified.
Oh. Mr. Lee, how do you respond to this last one? 45 to 50% of our licensed home inspectors are not qualified for the law to conduct parallel inspections. That's kind of shocking, isn't it?
Under the new law,
yeah.
This is exactly the point. This is exactly what we're looking to do. 45 to 50% of the inspectors actually mirrors the other two categories of 35 to 40% who do not qualify under the new laws that are doing parallel inspections. Not exactly a mirror, but the ratio is there. What we're trying to do is get those 35 to 40% of the people who are doing the parallels without the qualifications to stop doing. The other 50% of the home inspectors who do qualify that are doing parallels are more than likely the reason many of these inspectors get certified, because of being trained properly. Those that don't have the experience or the time for it. I don't agree with the board completely on the time frame. There's always exceptions to the rules as to who is good and who is bad, and there's always going to be a bad guy in there, and there's always going to be a good guy left out. But the truth of the matter is, over a five-year period of time, doing home inspections is what sets the home inspector apart from the builder. The builder builds a house, he knows his systems, he counts on his tradesmen, he may take a look at it or not, he may look at this, he may look at that every now and then. But the home inspector needs to understand what happens to houses when builders make mistakes. When age hits the house, when weather hits the house, the home inspector over a five-year period will have a lot more sense of what these elements have on the project that he's inspecting. And the people in the general public are actually depending on the home inspector as if he was the engineer. as if he was the architect, no matter how many times we tell them that we're just generalized home inspectors, they really expect us to know the business. And we don't feel that an inspector who hasn't been in the business for 5 years or an inspector who hasn't done 250 paid home inspections really knows this business.
When a home inspector is certified, is he minimally competent?
When a home inspector is certified, he's certified to the minimum bar. The home inspectors you see in this room and the home inspectors you see in our committees and the home inspectors hopefully you use for your own house are way above that bar. But what we're looking at here is a minimum standard, and trust me, none of us like it, but we were told that we don't want to put a burden on the general public, which also includes home inspectors, so we set a minimum bar. Now, if you get a license today and you meet the minimum bar after your third time getting through an enforcement advisory committee review for your application, and then 2 weeks later you go out to teach somebody how to do it, it's a scary world when these things happen. This is what we're trying to avoid. And I apologize for my numbers being off. If we're 9% of the community and we're 34% of the complaints, then this standard of 250 in 5 years, to me, may be too small as far as our Home Inspectors and Rules and Standards Committee looks at it. Architects and engineers go through major disciplines. Okay, they go through a very long period of time to get their licensing and their certification. We figured that a home inspector get his license within 6 months, and it'll cost him about $6,000 to $10,000, which as an entrance fee and an entrance investment into the program is very minor compared to many of the other professions. I'm sorry.
Oh no, that's fine. I my hang up is the 5 years for 250. That's one inspection a week. I'd rather have a guy have more inspections under his belt than the fact that he's been in the business for 5 years. I mean, was that ever considered to just have a number?
Well, the reason we put the two together, and we know that it's unrealistic for a home inspector to only have 250 home inspections in 5 years, is we don't want a home inspector to get certified for and hold on to his certification for 5 years and not do inspections. So we put a minimum of 250 inspections on the 5 years as well, just to be sure that the gentleman is at least doing all of it.
I mean, I see the merit of some period of time. Again, Mr. Leeds, I'm not sure about the 5 years, but I obviously don't want one guy who's had a certification for 4 months and, you know, in 4 months has done 250 inspections. Because, I mean, you still need to demonstrate that you can stay out of trouble, you know, with the board and that you're meeting your duties to your client. So I can see a period of time, but I would think it would be quite a bit less than 5 years if you've done 250 inspections and you've been working for a couple of years. That might make sense to me. So I did want to ask you, when you talked about InterNACHI and the requirements, the 250 and 5 years, where are those in InterNACHI? I saw in InterNACHI that you have to take a test and do some other stuff. What are those requirements for that you referenced?
For full membership. They have candidates in these
events. You're talking about OSHA, but not InterNACHI.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and the requirement is 250 and 5 years?
That's
there?
What I'm ready to believe.
Okay.
Now, our numbers reflect the fact that we've gotten more applications for home inspection certification in the past year and a half because the building market is good. So we have a lot of young, meaning licensed recently, home inspectors in that number of 844 now. So I think that's reflected in the statistics that Rob put together.
Yeah, and I think we have to balance, I mean, our duty to the public, to protect the public. At the same time, if at a time where the market is growing significantly, if we don't have enough home inspectors, that's a problem for the public in a different end.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, we believe we do have enough home inspectors. When we first certified, we certified 400. Most of those are still in business. but that was 18 years ago. However, 16. However, the associations are actually putting together programs and compiling lists of gentlemen that will be interested in doing parallel inspections with home inspectors.
Mr. Leeds, I have to stop you.
Yeah.
Are there any female home inspectors?
Yes.
Yeah,
please say people or something.
That is my fault. And with those lists, the associations do feel that they'll be able to provide enough home inspectors to do parallel inspections.
Okay. So, I'm going to go to Mr. Smith real quick, Carmen, just for one last comment. But I really want to have discussion with the board and just have you guys help us answer questions, because it'll facilitate, I think, the discussion. So, Mr. Smith?
Yeah, I did one more thing. I think this rule, this was put into place without real consideration for a school. This, to me, appears to be put in place for just a regular home inspector, but again, for a school. This is what we do every day.
Thank you. Carmen, sorry, you had something. Carmen had something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Oh, no, I was just wondering, during the rules writing, why you chose 3 years without disciplinary action versus 5 years in the business. Was there a discussion of that?
Yes, but I don't actually know that. 3 years without disciplinary action, I think, is had a precedent in other places.
Thank you.
I have an operational question for you. Mr. Smith is the only school that offers parallel inspections. So if you decide to proceed with rulemaking to accommodate him, it would be rulemaking to accommodate one person.
Yeah, I don't think we want to write any rule to accommodate any single individual. Obviously, our first priority is to protect the public, and that should guide our discussions. To the extent that we can mitigate issues for Mr. Smith or anybody else, we'd like to do that, but that's not our job. Okay.
Well, the other thing I have about this is, I mean, this has already been a rule, and we know how arduous it is to get the rule process going. You know, there's public input, and there's discussions, and I mean, it's made it through the rulemaking process, and Kirk, and everything else it has to go through. There was a lot of opportunity for people to come forward in the community and voice their opinions on this to help shape the rule that was actually put in place. It doesn't sound like anybody did this, or these gentlemen didn't do this, and the rule got put in place, and now that it is in place, they're trying to backpedal out of it. So I mean, there is a process to do this. I mean, us as a board didn't just make this up. It's not a substantial policy statement or something like that. I mean,
So if we follow your logic, though, how do we need to provide evidence to respond to their request as to why a rule makes sense?
I think part of the answer here is just the percentage we're seeing in the home inspections are not qualified. And the reports that we see coming through here that are incomplete. So I think Mr. Leeds has got a legitimate point. It'd be difficult, I think, for me at least, to support a reduction when we see so many complaints coming through this board.
I understand, Mr. Gilmore. I will say, personally, I think a lot of the complaints that come to home inspectors are just because of the misunderstanding of what they do by the general public. I mean, engineers and architects deal with a small population of people who look for their services. Home inspectors deal with everybody in the state who buys a home. And so they have, I think, what I'd be interested to know is how many of those actions end up being, disciplinary. And some of those are just formatting issues on the report, on reporting. Others are actually substance issues where they fail to notice things that are important.
But it's a lot. I mean, I don't know. I've been here doing this for 8 years, and there has been at least probably two or three home inspector ones on every agenda since I've been here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Way more than any other. And, there should be, if there are 8% of who we regulate, you would think that complaints should be, you know,
but how many 8%. Home inspections are there per year in the state?
Right, and there's a lot. But, you know, also the complaints that are being brought in, a lot of times when we're seeing them, it's this complaint was made, that complaint wasn't substantiated. But as, of course, the investigation, there's all these other issues that have came up. And mostly it's report writing and things that the parallel inspections are supposed to help. You know, if you have a parallel inspection, it's supposed to be, you know, right. You have a parallel inspection, you know how to write a report, you teach the new person how to write a report. If you don't know how to write a report and you're teaching someone else how to write it wrong too, it's just, you know, yeah. You're just, and then they get licensed and now they're teaching someone else how to write it wrong. You know, it's...
Okay, let me ask Mr. Donald, did you have something to say?
Well,
I saw you.
Well, the one point I wanted to bring up a few minutes ago was that the board is going to want to also be sure to differentiate when you look at whether or not this is an unduly burdensome rule. The issue is whether it's unduly burdensome in terms of licensing, not necessarily whether it's unduly burdensome in terms of collateral impact on associated industries. So to a certain degree, that would also be a factor in what exactly the requirement is. The requirement is, as I read the rule and as I read the rule procedure, legally, I believe the issue has to do with licensing pertaining to our licensees, not pertaining to licensing requirements that then subsequently impact academia or
businesses or others.
Yeah.
Okay. So does the new rule create overly burdensome challenges for people who want to enter the industry?
I would think from a legal standpoint, the board would want to, if they find there's an undue burden, they would want to be specific as to what the burden impacted specifically. We believe that ultimately in the review process, the question would come up if the board finds it's unduly burdensome. Is it unduly burdensome in terms of a licensing requirement, or is the unduly burdensome aspect a collateral impact on associated industry? So the board would want to be specific.
Thank you.
So the burden is you can't find somebody to do the parallel inspections.
That would be a burden.
That's
yes.
The burden.
Well, that's rural communities like this gentleman.
But even so, even here locally, look at all these numbers, looks like a lot of these guys aren't qualified to be the parallel inspector.
Well, half the population is qualified to be parallel inspectors.
Qualified.
Which is actually more than I thought. More than, I mean, half of them have 5+ years of experience based on these numbers. Mr. Smith, briefly, please.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on a point that this gentleman made regarding public opinion, or we had a chance to voice our concerns. I was not aware of this as a school or as a home inspector that this was even being proposed until after the fact. I finally got U.S. mail and I got an email stating that this rule just changed. So if there was no notice put out to the membership as to this change, otherwise that would have came up right away.
Okay. I think there's been official notice was posted. Understood. I mean, there's certain steps you have to meet to provide notice. I think all of those are met. I would agree that there's probably more ways we can disseminate information to reach more people. But all the official notices were provided. So that's...
I also believe that we sent out emails to everybody who gave us an email address. We can send emails, but we can't make sure you read it.
I've got emails from six people that work for me that are inspectors. They never got an email. They never got U.S. mail. He just said he never got it. Had we been notified like we were notified of the rule change, you would have had a different situation.
Understood, Mr. Smith, but I think we have to focus here on the issue at hand, which is
okay.
The rule itself.
All right.
Mr. Leeds, did you have another comment you wanted to make real quick?
No, it's already gone.
Okay, sorry about that.
I've got a question for Scott. What would be normal, or what would be an expectation during a rule change to accommodate the existing conditions? I mean, do we normally flip a switch and say the whole world changes today? Or is there, is it, nor, is that a fair question? Maybe that's not a fair question.
Well, from a legal standpoint, what you're asking about would be whether the board would choose to enforce an existing rule. The board doesn't have the authority to independently, of its own, on its own initiative, to create a grandfather clause or to create any kind of an alternate path to an existing rule. What would have to happen would be a question of whether the board would choose to enforce an existing rule that's on the books. As legal counsel for the board, I cannot advise that the board not enforce an existing rule.
Right. But I mean, in the rulemaking process, when this rule was created or presented and notification was served and so on and so forth, is there an expectation to accommodate or a standard of practice to accommodate existing conditions in rulemaking?
If I understand your question correctly, during the process, the multi-year process when this rule was proceeding from committee up to the board and then through rulemaking through GERC, the governor's council, everything, would the question be, was there any attempt made to accommodate people who might be impacted by that?
Yes, that's precisely the question.
They're actually statutorily, there are notice provisions. Every step of the process we have to, whether it's through agendizing for committee discussion, agendizing for the board to discuss, send it back for writing, come back to the board again to approve rules packets. That is all done through agenda. Additionally, once it's posted, there are requirements when it goes to GERC, it's posted officially, it has to go through a complete notice and comment stage. In fact, it's open for public comment all along the way as well. So there are requirements that did meet its statutory obligations. Well, stages of it. There isn't any obligation, well, there are statutory notice provisions. I'm not aware of any obligation that the board didn't.
The board could put in an effective date. It would have an option, but it doesn't have.
You can grandfather, but it's not required.
Yeah.
Mr. Roy?
My question would be along these lines. As soon as that point in time happens, the 3.5 years of experience doesn't cut it for the parallel inspectors. Now it's 5. So at that point, those 3.5 year people, they're out of whatever that particular job is. They're just an inspector. Now they can't parallel inspect. So in the rulemaking, can you say, okay, at this point, in 2 years or 1 year, this is when it's going to, this one you have to have 5 years experience, whatever it might be.
You could have written it that way.
But they didn't.
But there was no grandfather clause put into it, and my understanding is that there have been bad experiences with grandfather clauses in the past in a variety of situations. So there certainly could have been a grandfather clause put in, and I'm not...
Well, I think that we're looking at the people, we're looking at people with experiences, not the guy just got his license. We're looking at somebody who has 2 or 3 years experience. Now all of a sudden, 2 or 3 years is not good enough.
Right, I
so
think
the guys that are impacted.
The grandfather by experience, for instance, that Mr. Dowell might be referring to is when we had the 100 inspections. I mean, we did that as a transition mechanism, and it stayed on the books for 15 years. So once you grandfather something, you have to remember to take it out, is I think part of the concern.
Well, it's a grandfathering in a sense. It's not going to come into full play
right.
for a year and a half.
Right.
You're not adding any more people to it other than your...
Yeah.
Kind of breaks.
That would have been written into the rule, which is already in place.
Yeah.
So this discussion isn't about the rule. That happened, I don't know when this, when did all this discussion happen? Years ago? A couple years ago?
About the
when did this rule change?
Inspections.
Yeah. When was
it started about 2 years ago at the committee level when they looked at statistics like this.
Right.
And we were trying to get home inspectors to help us look at reports because they were deficient.
So this process has been going on to get to the point where the rule was actually published. It's been about 2 years of time of notifications and, you know, all the board notifications, all the home inspector you know, meeting notifications, everything. I mean, over and over, everything's been notified that, and throughout that whole time, anybody could have came in and spoke about it, you know, and given their opinion on it.
Right. Let me, but that doesn't mean that the rule is right or not. Just because. So, yes, sir.
I mean, just real quick. I'm on the EAC, been on it for about 9 months. When Robert sent out an email, what, a week or two ago, that's the first I'd heard about it. You guys did a great job on telling us about the fingerprint changing. Everybody knew about that way ahead of time. Didn't hear anything about this until a month later.
Would you like me to discuss, because I'm the gentleman who posted the agendas and the notes and things of that nature, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, but I don't believe that there's anything in our statutes that says that I have to send out an email to the population regarding rule notices.
No. But again, I think there's, you know, there's the minimum required notices, and then there's additional outreach we can do, which is, I think, what we did with the fingerprints. We did additional outreach. So, again, it's a best practice. I think we should try for that every time. But just to frame the discussion again, what we have to decide here today is, do we want to modify the rule, or do we want to respond and say, nope, our rule is correct as is because of X, Y, and Z? That's really what we have to decide today.
Rob had a suggestion that might make all parties more comfortable, an amendment that makes the 5 years, allows people with 3 years experience now, and makes the 5 years absolute in 2 more years. So,
well, we would have to modify the rule to do that.
We would have to modify the rule to do that.
So right. Say that again, 3 years, what?
For now, people with 3 or more years experience to do parallels within a year and a half, 2 years, they would have to have that 5. That would allow the people who qualify now with some reasonable experience to grow into Peter's concerns that people need more training.
So are we as a board allowed to just say this will go into effect October 1st, 2020? Okay, my work on another board was that our things that start with R were like sacrosanct and we couldn't touch them at all. So what are our legal options sitting here today?
Well, where we are right now is statutorily there's been a challenge to a rule and the board has to provide an answer to either justify the existence of the rule or begin the rulemaking process to change the rule. To change the rule. The board doesn't have the ability to, of its own initiative today, say, okay, we're done with that, we're going to give you an extra 2 years. They would have to go through the process before they're going to turn
around. And that process is about 2 years long.
Well, is it the standard process if the rule is challenged?
Right?
Sorry, Karen.
Well, yeah, please.
If the rule is challenged, is it the standard process or a different process? To change the rule.
We're in a brand new process here. This is because this means of challenging the rule has just gone into effect. I don't know that FERC has policies and procedures in place right now, but there is a general statute that theoretically this would proceed on a fairly accelerated basis. The real question is going to be, well, there are the two issues. The one is concerning whether to accept or modify the existing rule. The second one, which again is the one that, you know, it probably is the question that the gentleman here before would have to do with enforcement of the rule. So the board would have to decide a couple of different things. And again, from a legal standpoint, I can only advise enforcing the existing rule.
I personally would not be in favor of not enforcing a rule.
Right,
that'd be a bad precedent.
Going back to timeline, okay, realistically, even if there is some accelerated, which it's the government, so it's not going to be accelerated, it still has to go to committee, and it still has to be discussed in the Home Inspector Rules Committee, right? Then it has to go to the board.
No, it would, no, what would happen is it would go to Kirk from, basically the board is going to accept or reject a petition, and then that would be going, we'll be going to council from the board. The board has 60 days from the date of the petition, which we're considering the email, to reject the petition and state the reasons in writing for denial or initiate rulemaking proceedings in accordance with the chapter, or if otherwise lawful, make a rule that the board does not have the lawful authority to make the rule itself. Beyond that,
but if what I'm hearing you saying is, if the two choices are either you know, say that the rule is adequate as written, or go through the process of changing the rule. Well, going through the process of changing the rule is the whole entire process of the committee has to decide on a new rule, and then it has to go to the board, and then, right? I mean, is that correct?
What you have to do, what you have to do in the 60 days if you decide to amend the rule is at least open the docket.
Yeah, start the process.
Yeah, it's not like it's done in 60 days.
Right. Within 60 days, you have to start the process, but then you have to go through the whole entire process, which this last time to do this took 2 years. You know, we're saying it's going to be accelerated, but it still has to go, you know, the new, a modified rule has to be made, and then it has to go through, you know, for approval, and then it has to go to GIRC, and then it has to have public opinion, and then, so, okay, so it's 60 days plus then whatever timeline.
A year at the expedited
right on. Right, and that's the problem at this point, especially considering this is a brand new statute, it's difficult to say what the exact time frame could be for a group review of a rule under these circumstances.
Right. Well, I guess one thing I just want, you know, these gentlemen to know is, no matter what comes about today, the rule that's on the books is still on the books and will be on the books until it, if it's even changed. So it still could be.
Yep.
A year, and that I think that's being very optimistic.
You don't know because it's so new.
So, well,
right. We don't know. It's always been a long process. We hope that if we decide to change it, that it's shorter. I do think just because the process is complicated doesn't mean we should shy away from it if we have a bad rule. If the rule is good as is, then we should.
Right. I just don't want them to have an expectation that
coming out of this
board meeting is tomorrow they can start doing parallel inspections with their inspectors. The rule is still there. The law is still the law. So until it gets, if it gets changed, until it gets changed, it's still the law. So, you know, I just don't want any false expectations that whatever we vote on here changes the rule. The rule is the rule. It's we're past the point of public discussion to make the rule. It's there.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have to decide, you know, if we want to change it in the future, you know, or if we want to open the docket to
exactly
try to
open the docket.
Future.
All we have to decide is open the docket or leave it as is. Jason, did you have something?
Yeah, Scott, if we accept the petition and we open the docket, is it open to everything or is it limited to just the question in the petition?
That's all right. But you would be opening the docket for the limited purposes of modifying the rule to what you would like to modify it to. You wouldn't be...
Are we limited just to the specific question, or if we see incidental abrasion, can we correct incidental abrasion as a board?
I think it's going to be specific to the question raised. I mean, otherwise you're getting into the general rule writing process. If you want to, now if the board just simply wants to review their rules and draft a new rule packet, that would be another thing altogether. The board could do that as well. But if you want to start looking more comprehensively at changing entire sections of the rules, I think you're legally looking more at general rule.
I guess what I want to clarify, if for the petitioner's sake, since nobody knows what the petition is or the process is, do we feel that his petition is sufficiently meets his concerns? Or did it, I mean, because we're all walking into this thing blind.
Certainly. I would sum it up as his petition is that the rule that requires 250 inspections and 5 years is overly burdensome. Right. That's what the claim is. So we'd have to open the rule that describes what a parallel inspector is and evaluate how we would modify that rule to alleviate his concern. It doesn't mean, I don't think it means we have to adopt his solutions of an additional certification or any of that stuff. It just means we're going to reopen the docket to address his concern that 250 and 5 is overly burdensome.
What I want to be clear, though, with the petitioner is that did he just send us an email with a question and we're saying, oh, that's his petition, that's all he gets? Or does he have the opportunity to really clarify on a petition? You know, did he know that he was sending a petition when he sent us what he thought might be a complaint or something else?
Melissa?
I just have something to add, and that is there's a rules moratorium that's still in place, so we have to ask the governor for permission to open a docket.
Wow.
Give him a call.
Right.
But we're bound by statutes more than that. So.
The governor's initiative, so the governor's going to okay.
Yeah.
But I guess back to my point, though, is when Mr. Smith submitted this email, did he understand that this was going to be his petition?
Did he intend it as a petition?
Yeah, or was it just a question to the board? Or, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to open this thing up on limited information if we're going to do it.
I was hoping it would be interpreted as a petition.
Okay.
And I was under the impression that a change to the rules could be an expedited procedure through this board. You are the DPR. By making the amendment to it, it could be expedited through the process.
Okay. I think I understand that we take it as a petition. Unfortunately, we cannot make rules, so we would have to go through the rulemaking process. I think, as Mr. Scott said, Mr. Donald said, is, you know, hopefully there's an expedited process, but we don't know. We really have no idea of how long it'll take.
I've done a lot of rulemaking over the years. There's an expedited process. I don't know how much faster it is. I've actually heard first complaint it's not that much faster. But to Jason's point, if you want to do something with this particular rule, if you open just it, and we go through the docket opening, and we go through the proposed rulemaking, and we go through the final rulemaking, it will be much faster than if
the rule packet.
The rule, yeah. The broader it is, the more likely you are to get comment. It's comment that will slow down the process. So.
Thank you.
Again, just an observation. You know, not taking any sides, but I mean, obviously there was an intent behind the rule change to enhance the Home Inspection Practice Act. I mean, we don't tend to want to diminish the value. So I would have thought that, you know, given the high rate of disciplinary actions in the home inspection industry, as demonstrated by the statistics, would this rule change be beneficial to the home inspection practice and lower, if that was the intent of the rule change? I mean, the proof is in the pudding. If you roll this rule out, you don't see any change whatsoever in the behavior of the products that the industry is producing, well then it was transparent to the rule change. Rule change had no value or benefit added, and therefore, you know, perhaps revising it back to the old would be warranted or some other modification. But to make the modification a priori without seeing the outcome of the benefits of the rule change, if there are any benefits, is indeterminate. I mean, I don't know how you go forward and modify something that's untested. We don't know whether or not this is going to enhance the product end result.
And we don't know it won't either.
And we don't know it won't either. It may make no difference.
It is a new rule.
Yeah. So my personal opinion on this is if we're going to say no, we need to defend the rule. I am not personally comfortable with the 5-year requirement. I think it's a little bit arbitrary. I am all for the 250 inspections. Looking at the ASHI requirements, the requirement for certified home inspectors, which is the highest grade, is 250 inspections, but it does not require a time frame, at least from what I see on the website. I mean, that's the extent of the research I've done. So I have a hard time defending the rule. I understand that changing the rule is a painful process and that we should be changing rules all the time to make minor modifications. But with the new legislation that we have, we either have to defend the rule or start the rulemaking process. I would be inclined to start the rulemaking process and just change the, you know, keep the 250, but evaluate what the right number of years is. And I could see in a 2-3 year range as opposed to a 5-year range. So that's my personal take on it. And let me hear Mr. Leeds first, Jason, is that okay?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, before you take a motion, I do want you to remember that we've gone 18 years without the rule and we know it doesn't work. On the other hand, 50% of the home inspectors in this state already qualify under the new rule. I don't see it as a burden. Every day an anniversary will come up and another home inspector is going to qualify under the new rule. So the club of the home inspectors that can do parallels under the new inspection is growing every day. And we're already 50% of the industry, so I don't see that the 250 inspections nor the 5 years are a burden. You also want to please remember that the Home Inspectors Rules and Standards Committee has been battling this for years, and the 250 was justified in discussion over and over and over, as well as the 5 years. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Lee said, by the way, I think I speak for all of us here, we really appreciate what you and the committee do. I mean, you put a tremendous amount of time, so we by no means intend to undermine that.
We know this.
Jason?
I just want to say that I'm comfortable with the rules themselves. I think that the people that have 18 years of experience in the home inspection profession came up with this for good reasons, and I hope that they're successful. But on the other hand, when I have two home inspectors sitting here, they have the right to petition this rule change, and I want to be very respectful of that, whether their cause is something I agree with or not. I really want to be respectful of that. So.
Mr. Smith, how hard would it be to hire more inspectors to do the parallels you have 5 years?
All right, well, so here's the thing. I've got a home inspection business as well, and these guys work for me in my home inspection business. I've got them as inspectors as well. So now what's going to happen is they're going to take such a big cut in pay. They're going to take it from $600 to $1,300 a month pay cut because they can't do the parallels along with the inspection. So my home inspection business is set up, and that's kind of how I made that. I kind of blended it into the school. So I know my inspectors. I know my inspectors are good inspectors. I know that they can do good parallels. I know they write good reports. I don't know somebody outside of my school what their standards are. I don't know how good of a product they would put out as a parallel.
But you could hire 2 or 3
I could.
People. Okay.
Yeah.
But that's a business question again. I don't think that's what we're looking at. I have a question for you, Melissa. What percent, I mean, do we know, we have 34% of our complaints are home inspectors.
Correct.
Do we know how that breaks up in terms of experience levels? I mean, are the people that are facing the complaints all new inspectors, or is it evenly distributed regardless of years of experience?
We don't know. That would be something we could ask.
I think that's very important if we want to justify that you need a certain number of years of experience. We need to show that it's the newer people that are getting cases. If that's not the case, I don't see justification for needing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we noticed that in the last several months where these inspectors who are up here, they said, I've done 3,000, 6,000 inspections, and this is my very first time I've ever been here. And that's happened a lot. And I guess one other question is there some sort of template for inspections? That's something you guys really work on, a standard.
Yeah, they're in the new rules.
So what's the difficulty in following that? And
exactly.
It looks like there's only 15%
of that. And sometimes, realistically, it's more an issue of continuing education than anything else. I mean, the guys who have been certified for 10 or 15 years sometimes don't know what the current standard is.
Yeah. Well, and let's face it, before I became executive director and we integrated home inspections into how we enforce and how we license, they used to be a separate little side unit here at the board with no oversight at all. So we may have people out there with 3,000 inspections who don't understand there are standards and requirements.
And 3,000 of the wrong form that they bought from, I don't know, law forms on .com or
just because you did 3,000 inspections, 3,000 home inspections.
Is the burden really on re-justifying the existing rule? In other words, if we want to say we're okay with the existing rule based on history, based on the experience from the...
We can do that if we deny...
But if we deny, do we have to re-justify it?
Well, under the statute, you need to, if you reject the petition, you need to state the reasons in writing for denial to the petitioner.
Which could include not seeing a good reason to change the rule.
Yes.
That could be. Now, that can be appealed to the council for review as well. And then the council would, I don't know, again, we don't really have any experience with where this would go from that point, but essentially the board would want to be able to provide in writing for not necessarily a justification for the rule, but why.
I would think in the current climate, we would need to justify, Andy, I mean, we would need to justify, one, why it's necessary to protect the public, and two, why it's not overly burdensome. I mean, us just saying, you know, we've reviewed our rule and we think it's still needed, you know, sure we can say that, but it's probably going to come back and appeal back to us. If we decide to keep the rule, we need to explain why it's not overly burdensome, I think. That was the whole intent of the...
I believe that under the statute, it would be good for the board to be able to enunciate why the rule, not necessarily why the rule isn't unduly burdensome, because that gets into sort of trying to prove a negative, but more just why the rule is a benefit to the rule. I guess to a certain degree, I guess it would be justifying the rule.
Which, you know, involving the home inspector, the home inspector standard committee that spent numerous years crafting it. I mean, they obviously had reasons why, so, you know, that's the justification. This wasn't some willy-nilly thing that just popped up.
Well, but I'm going to be the devil's advocate, Jason, which is, just disagree with you because I've only been here 8 years. no, but the point is, if we come back and say, you know, a group of home inspectors got together, and this is how it's going to be interpreted, a group of home inspectors got together and decided that they needed to make it more difficult for people to become home inspectors, the politicians and the conservatives are immediately going to go and say, you're just doing exactly what the North Carolina board did, and you're trying to keep active market participants in determining what other people need to do to enter the profession. So I think just saying that, you know, home inspectors looked at and decided won't cut it. I think we need to say, you know, if we can show in our discipline, we see that the inexperienced inspectors are the ones that are getting the discipline all the time, so we need better trainers, I can see that as a great justification for it.
Right, and that can be part of the justification, but I think you also need to speak to why, you know, what Mr. Leeds was talking about. These are the reasons we came up with this rule.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just a group of home inspectors. It's three home inspectors. It's a board member, which currently is me. And it's a public member, who is currently Andy, and it was Doug Folk before that. So it's not just they got together.
No, that's a better way to phrase it.
You know, they got together in a little group and decided, hey, we're going to screw everyone else. You know, I mean, and every single meeting was open to the public. Anybody could came in and spoke about it at any time. So, you know, it's a little different. It, you know, it's not a little cabal that got together and, you know, decided to, you know, mess with everyone. I mean, it's an open public meeting.
And arguably, it's no more burdensome on applicants because they still have to get the 30 parallels. So now they have to get it from somebody who has 5 years of experience instead of somebody with 1 year or 3 years of experience. They're still paying for them. They still have to do them.
Yeah. It might take them longer.
If we were to respect the appeal here, how much effort would it cost the board? Would there be staff time, a bunch of staff time, money, so on and so forth? So
if we were to do what?
To respect this appeal. And
respect meaning rulemaking?
Yeah, open up the
petition.
The petition. You know, if it's something that we've just paid for in the last 2 years and allocated resources to. Yes, go ahead.
I don't think it's that burdensome.
Yeah, if I may, as board counsel, I would advise the board not to determine whether or not to proceed with the rulemaking based upon any resource allocation. It should be a straight-up question of whether the rule, whether it's a justified rule or whether it does create some sort of unwieldy burden on licensees. We don't really want to get, or the board should not get into an analysis of cost-benefit analysis of pursuing the petition.
Okay.
And is the rule, is the law the burdensome, is it burdensome on becoming licensed, newly licensed, or burdensome on current licensees, or is there no delineation?
The issue under the statute, as I see it is a regulatory licensing requirement. Whether it is unduly burdensome or not demonstrated to be necessary to specifically fulfill public health, safety, or welfare concern, it's going to be whether it's unduly burdensome as a regulatory licensing requirement, which would, as I read the statute, be a question of whether it's licensing, not whether it's a collateral licensing issue. For example, if you were looking at a similar rule concerning dentists, and it had to do with whether a dental instructor had a university education as opposed to an alternate path, and they said you have to have a university education, would that really impact the ability of people to get licensed, or would they still have the exact same requirements, but would the burden fall on instructors or collateral industries that may have been able to educate under the old paradigm but may not be able to under the current one? So it's really a question, as I see it from the statutes, of whether it's imposing a burden on people trying to become licensed.
Okay. And that brings up Melissa's point. If you're applying for a license, you still need to get 250 parallel inspections. 30 parallel inspections. But the person that does them for you has a higher level of qualification. But, you know, the numbers that statistics show is there's 50% of the home inspectors out there. And how many home inspectors do we have currently?
844.
So there's, what, you know, 422 people out there that are qualified to provide this service. So, you know, I think that's, we have to look at that. It's not, to all due respect to these gentlemen, it's not burdensome on, I don't think the law is written to help them out. It's, the law is written to help out new people who are applying. So, you know, that's just something to consider.
Well, two things, Jason. I mean, one is, yes, half of them could be eligible, but if you look at a rural area, I mean, if he's got 18 people in his entire county, that does cut the population down quite a bit, and in all cases, it might lead to taking longer to complete your 30 parallels if there's less people available, because not all 400 of them are going to want to be parallel. And secondly, the way I read the rule, now that Mr. Donald reiterated it, is two things. I mean, it's they can challenge any requirement that's unduly burdensome or is not demonstrated to be necessary to specifically fulfill a public health, safety, or welfare concern. So it's not just about burden, it's about demonstrating that it can protect the public. So, goes back to the original point to me is, do we need 5 years to demonstrate we can protect the public? I would be very comfortable saying that the rule is necessary if we can show that with our enforcement history that people with more experience have significantly lower action rate, you know, discipline rate. Mm-hmm. If once you get to 5 years, your discipline rate drops significantly. I think we have a great point to make about why it's needed and why it protects the public. If it's flat, regardless of how long they've been registered, I have a hard time defending a rule. So my question was, when did we get the request, Melissa? And can we do that research between now and the next board meeting and still meet our 60-day timeline?
I don't know.
It was emailed to you, so you have the data
on your computer. I think it was it the 13th or was it officially after the home inspector meeting?
Yeah.
It was the day after.
Okay. So...
That I think is a deterministic approach, and that gets to the point, did the new rule change enhance the home industry practice by mandating 5 years, because it would weed out, you know, all of the, let's say, novice or young home inspector, I shouldn't say young in the industry.
Yeah. New.
From performing parallel inspections and therefore being being not as highly qualified as one who has 5 years. So we need a measure to see whether or not this would tend to enhance the population of home inspectors who are then qualified to admit the new entrants in their 30 parallel inspection, to fulfill their 30 parallel inspection requirement. And I think it's deterministic and it's something which we can quantify. I mean, that's really what it's going to amount to if we honor this, or if we want to disposition this petition.
It could help us one way or the other to say our rule is good, or
yeah.
You know, maybe we can look at the rule.
At this point it's impartial, the outcome we don't know, but I think it would be, you know, retro, it would be a good insight into justifying their five-year approach. Yeah.
Probably going to need those facts either way.
What's that?
We're going to need those facts either way.
Yeah. I think so, too. Patty, do we know? I mean, can we meet next month and still be within the 60-day timeline?
We would be. Essentially, you have 2 months, but
right.
We would have to decide right then. So just let me take another look. Let me show it to Scott.
So. Let me figure it out here.
Sorry,
or
Jason.
Perhaps Mr. Smith could just avow to wait for the outcome of this petition until after the October meeting.
See, this is why you want me off the board, Melissa. Trying to make sure you find a replacement.
You know that.
Me too.
Yeah. Sorry. But let me get an idea. Would you guys, I mean, in general, the board, would you guys and gals want
to
see that information before we decide, or do you feel like we should make a recommendation today?
We get it.
Or some kind of,
but if they made a decision in October, that would be this time.
Oh, yeah. They are thinking October would be.
Yes, the October meeting would be okay. The board, the requirement of the statute is within 60 days of receiving the petition, so if there's a meeting at the October meeting, the board would be able to consider it. We could come back with whatever statistical information the board would like at that point. We could defer a decision until that board meeting for further consideration. But the board would have to reach a decision at that point and would have to be able to either approve the petition or, if they rejected it, to be able to provide a written
direct staff on how to respond.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I interject something? I think we have to define right now what it is we want statistically determined. Mm-hmm. Let's be precise. We want to go back and look at the population. Well, first we have a global population of home inspectors who have what is the rate of discipline I heard as high as...
844 registrants and 34% of all discipline.
34%. So 34% in the gross population seems to be what they're putting out. If we look at it from an age-related slice, so those, again, I keep saying age.
Yeah, you mean date of registration.
The day of registration up to 5 years. If that number of disciplinary cases, based on their population subset, is greater than 34%. I'm trying to come up with some measure of success.
Well,
what are we trying to achieve in examining those statistics?
Yeah, my suggestion would be that we look at home inspector cases over the last 3 years, right? And then over the last 3 years, we look at cases that are related to not meeting the standards. I don't think we want cases where somebody didn't have financial assurances or cases where they forgot to renew on time or anything like that. So let's pull the cases that have to do with meeting the minimum standards. And then we go and figure out how long in their career had they been when the complaint came in relative to the initial registration date. So had they been registered 2 years or 3 years or one or five?
Okay.
And then knowing what percentage of people we have in each bracket, 0 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3, whatever, we just see what the violation rate is for each experience level.
And if there's any demarcation at 5
and if there's
five,
a big,
yeah,
you know,
a big jump,
yeah,
at the 5-year or 4-year or 3-year or 2-year,
yeah,
we can make a call on that.
You are
going to
have people who were grandfathered in, never took the test, never took the classes, so you probably would need to factor that in.
If
they've been practicing for a long time but never
went
through the training.
Right. They can be parallels.
And I would caution against a false statistic then. If there's people that were grandfathered in that may have not met a rigorous standard, we probably should keep an eye out for that, weighing the statistics, making it look like the more you practice, the worse you get. not let that get in,
yeah,
the mix.
That should the rule say that you need to take the exam to be a parallel? If you're saying that you didn't take the exam and then you shouldn't do it? I mean, I think we need to account for anybody who has 5 years. Anybody who meets the requirements of our current rule, 5 years or not, regardless of whether they took the test or not. Because they could be parallels.
They had to have taken the test, Mr. Chairman, even when they were grandfathered. That was part of their rule.
Okay.
There's nobody in the industry that hasn't taken the national exam within 2 years of their application.
Thank you, Mr. Leeds. Good to know. Yes, Mr. Smith. And let's try to wrap it up in 5 minutes to move to the next item.
On your collection of data, can you also maybe go into, on those violations, what training provider was...
I don't think that's relevant. I don't think it's as relevant. I mean, respectfully, I don't think that's the point, because our rule is not...
Okay.
Yeah, the specific rule is just 250 in 5 years, so
okay.
I think that's what we want to get at.
Okay.
Thank you, though. Okay. So what do we want to do at this point? Do we want to act today, or do we want to go through this work? I mean, I know it's work for the board. I'm happy to help you, Melissa, if we decide to go down that route. And Rob, I'll work with Rob if you want. But if we want to move on now, we can...
I'd like to see the data.
No, I want to see the data.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so we'll include this item on the table list till the October agenda. And I appreciate you guys' input. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, if anybody wants to stay for 9C.
I'll stay for your 9C.
If you want to try it.
I was curious if we can take a quick break.
Oh, yeah, we can take a quick break. So, how about we get together again at 12? Reconvene at 12?
Yeah.
Thank you, guys. We should be close. Get back in session. Let's Mr. Winters, can you start the recording again, please?
All right.
It's 12 o'clock. We're going to go complete item 9C, and then we have a pending item 7A, but let's finish all the 9s.
9C comes before you as a result of what occurred at the Home Inspector Rules and Standards Committee, which was a request from a different home inspector who believes that ultimately, and this is a decision or a discussion that they're going to have at the home inspection meeting, that home inspectors deserve a seat at this table. And after I discussed that with him and we looked at the statute, in the statute it does allow the Home Inspector Rules and Standards Committee to review disciplinary recommendations. So he requested that all the severe disciplinary recommendations from EAC committees involving home inspectors actually go to the Home Inspection Committee for a blessing, more or less, before they come to the board. And he heard the discussion, as did the members of the committee, that it would prolong investigations sometimes needlessly because we trust, and the board members trust, the recommendations we receive from the home inspector EAC committees. And yet there was some discussion, and I think Peter can shed some more light on it if you wish, about whether that's a good idea or not. So that's why it's here.
Thank you. Can you, I'd like to hear from Mr. Leitz on this issue and his take. Would you also, Mr. Leitz, tell us what the composition is of the Home Inspectors Committee?
The Home Inspector Committee really isn't too interested in getting in putting another cog in the wheel. However, some of the severe issues that go to the board without us seeing it, the Rules and Standards Committee does not trust the EAC committee members as much as we trust ourselves. And just as another, maybe a letter of explanation or just some type of recommendation on the severe issues come from staff to our committee prior to coming to you at the board. We understand there's a logistical problem here, that the board and your Rules and Standards Committees meet at different times, and we don't meet as often as you do, and it may delay action on several of the issues. Personally, and I'm talking personally now, not from the committee, I don't want to stand. But the Rules and Standards Committee made a recommendation because most of the committee does.
Thank you, Mr. Freed.
Well, I guess since I wasn't at the meeting,
you missed a good one.
I see that. But I guess the question is, does the gentleman that was there feel that the recommendations the EAC is giving to the board too lax or too strict or not right or what?
We got into that discussion, and my contention was that we never make recommendations to the boards for disciplinary action. We rate items based upon the severity and let the board decide. There was one case, I think, that maybe it didn't actually go through the committee, or through an EAC committee, where a severe recommendation was made to the board. I'm not here to defend this request. I'm actually here just to see what the outcome is. But there's nobody really interested in circumventing the EAC committee results. But the committee thought that maybe it would be a good idea on severe cases.
And I actually offered to do a report to them about how many times the board accepts a recommendation regarding home inspector discipline and how many times they modify recommendations.
But the recommendations are from staff, aren't they? Look what Mr. Leeds say is,
yeah.
I mean, the EAC gets together, tells us what the violations are and how severe, mm-hmm. And then staff compares to previous cases and proposes something for us to review.
Sure.
Would the committee have to define severity of it?
Yeah, I think part of the discussion on that had to do with suspensions or revocations.
Right.
I mean, I think we'd have to, but I think part of the concern is that without a representative on this board, that we're giving recommendations, and if we are going to do something as severe as suspension or revocation, they might like another set of eyes on it.
Well, have we had any that have been suspension revocation ones?
We got one coming up.
Just the one that's going to
Oh, well, yes. I mean, you know.
Hey, you asked.
Well, yeah.
We haven't had one for about an hour, Jason.
That's true. So, I mean...
Beyond that, my comment was, I don't think we've had a lot of severe discipline for inspectors.
And I think, you know, us as a board have been fair and changed up in both directions. You know, sometimes it'll come in and we'll read through stuff and be like, I don't agree, and we'll lessen it. Or sometimes we've increased it. Most of the time we, you know, kind of stay right with, you know, what the thought is. But it's not like we're just, whatever the EAC says, we just accept.
I think we do give deference to the EAC.
Yeah.
But then when we...
Yes, we should.
Right.
Yeah.
But when we've modified it, in my recollection, it seems to be more, hey, we've found... two violations, and so under the rules we can, you know, double the fine, or this is really just one, we cut it in half, that type of thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think
it's so. I'm not as concerned because I don't think it's as discipline specific as someone might be thinking. Mm-hmm.
And who makes up the committee?
It's
two of you guys, right?
Two of three us. Home inspectors.
Three home inspectors. Yeah. Okay.
Three very old.
experience.
Old.
Very good.
Experience.
No, very good.
Yeah.
And one of those on the committee has to represent a smaller county in Arizona. So it's not just Maricopa County or Pima County. It's someone from a 400,000 or less population.
You?
Scott,
you
this,
want to be on the committee?
No, I do not.
That's what we just...
So moved. No. Yeah. I know where you live. This is a question for Scott. Given that we're having this hearing on November 9th or
19th,
is that maybe out of line here? Something Mr. Leeds could attend? And he seems to have a lot of knowledge on this issue. It's a tough case. Is he allowed to talk? Something.
At a hearing?
Uh-huh.
Well, I could call him as a witness. In this particular case, as a matter of fact, if Mr. Leeds would like to testify as to the standard of practice of an inspector, we'd be more than happy to have him.
What's the case?
Bartholomew. The gentleman with the video.
Oh, the gentleman in the drawer?
Yes.
The gentleman in the drawers. That's it, yeah. Something like that.
The chest of drawers. You
said in the chest and drawer? I'm always happy to
have him. Okay. Yes, Mr. Lee, as a matter of fact.
I think that could provide a perspective that they are valuable.
So I'm wondering if there's a sort of a middle step here, because I do worry, I worry about, one, the timing on the cases. I worry also about duplicating what the EAC did already, because it's, you know, a majority of home inspectors again. Once again, you go back to North Carolina court case, we already had review by home inspectors. Could there be, and I'm not sure that there is an issue yet. I don't know that we've had an issue. Is there a step where instead of running it by the committee before it comes here, we deal with it, but we report to the committee at every meeting on what discipline has been taken that's been beyond a letter of reprimand and provide the facts of the case to the committee so the committee can start looking at them, and if they see a pattern where it doesn't match what they expect, then we take action. But if it looks okay.
That was my thought, too.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
you're
talking about sending the committee a list and of cases with disciplinary action prior to your moving on them?
No, Mr. Leeds, what I was suggesting is that after we act on it, but before your meeting, we collect all the cases. You meet quarterly, or how often do you meet?
We try to do it quarterly.
Yeah. So we would send you any cases that involve home inspectors that quarter that went beyond a letter of reprimand. So anything that was serious, we would send to you with the docket so you can review the case, the EAC recommendation, everything, and see if you had any concerns with the work the board or staff did. After the fact. And if you start identifying a pattern where it's a problem or where you disagree with it, then we would take the next step and see how we can improve the process, whether it's prior review by the committee or something else. But given that there's not an identified issue specifically and that there are some drawbacks, I'm hesitant to move directly to review of all the cases. Because that also would mean we would have a lot of home inspector cases potentially every quarter after you guys meet.
And then we triple the work of the rules and standards.
Yeah, which you probably have more important. I mean, your job is the rules and standards.
That's a fact.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Okay. Thank you. A list after the fact is would be fine with me, and I'm sure the committee would be satisfied with that.
Okay. Yeah.
Just to monitor tracks.
Yeah, and I think we can be open to more if it's necessary, but...
Yeah.
Thank you.
So direction to staff in that regard?
Yes, unless anybody on the board has a problem, concern.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. Mr. Winters, do you want to try Mr. Kyle Marquis again? Home inspectors might have the most cases, but the weird ones are always architects.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Deviants.
What is that?
You are weird.
This is Kyle Marquis with Thrive Construction.
Please get a voicemail
number, and I'll contact you as soon as possible. Thank you.
At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
This message is for Mr. Marquis. This is Kurt Winter, the Arizona Board of Technical Registration, here at the boardroom trying to get in contact with you for your agendized item. We didn't reach you, so we're going to proceed with the matter. And we tried you earlier today, but we were unable to leave a message at that time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Winter. Okay. So you have the case in front of you. There were two issues. Mr. McKee had a criminal violation prior to his application, and he failed to disclose that violation on his application. Anybody wants to get into details on what happened? Read the packet. What's that?
I said, do we have any video?
I hope not.
He's technically qualified for registration, and he is registered in other states.
But wait.
There's more.
No.
There's more.
Two questions. I mean, one is, I mean, his violation itself doesn't worry me as much. Anybody can have a lapse. Not that I've done it.
And do that Hobby Lobby lot.
Yeah. But the fact that he didn't disclose
correct
is what worries me. Because on his letter he said, you know, it's very embarrassed. It'll never happen again. It's never, like, it worries me that in his professional life he's going to hide his mistakes from people to not admit him.
Right.
So that could harm the public.
True.
That's number one. And number two, do we know that he has disclosed this issue to other states?
We do not know that.
Because he's on five or six states, some of them we should have renewed at around 2017 after this happened.
Mm-hmm. Can you find it? Can you find out?
Right. Pardon me?
Can you find out?
I guess if he has an NCART record,
He does have an NCART record. Funny thing is, he has no discipline in any states.
Right.
So I would have expected some sort of discipline if he disclosed this.
I agree with Alejandro. I can't believe I said that, but
it hurts.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not really, I think the disclosure is, and not even having a, you know, reason why. I mean, he can't say he forgot. I mean, it was...
Yeah, you don't forget that stuff.
So then when it was brought up, he provides a different version
right.
than what's in the police report.
Right.
So it's...
Well, if you're inclined to table this, we can contact NCARB and see if they have any updates or the other states to see if they know that this occurred 2 years ago. If you would, if you believe that information is necessary to make your decision.
Well, I don't know why that would be necessary for us. I mean, what other states did or not, it's what's it matter to right. us to the,
that's true.
To accept or deny. I mean, maybe we could, you know, if we deny, I mean, I suppose you could direct staff to contact NCARB of the other states and explain
notify.
Why we did, but I don't even know if we need to do that.
If we deny this, can he reapply?
We would have, if he appeals, we have to have a formal hearing on the denial, justifying why we decided to deny. And that could be here, or it can be at OWA. And
who decides that, my dear?
We
do.
Yeah. And
so I know it's not customary to deny based on just failure to disclose in an application, but I think this one, I think the reason he failed to disclose is, you know, he wanted to hide his mistakes purposefully, and again, that's worrisome to me.
Well, lying in a board application, I believe, is absolutely a justification for denial if the board wants to go that direction. And I would even be willing to argue that the basis for the lying is beside the point if the basis is lying on an application. So I don't believe that the board is required to grant it. I don't believe the board is required to deny it. I think it's fully within the board's discretion. But if it is for the basis of the conduct, then that should be enunciated. Or if it is for the basis of lying on the application itself, and what one could draw from that in terms of how that would impact practice, and impact on potential public trust, and whether or not he may pose a threat to the public in his practice, then I think the board should enunciate that.
And I was looking at your faces as you read the case.
I was stuck on the details of the case. But you lie on an application about something that just happened, so it's not like, oh, I had a speeding ticket 7 years ago, and that might have been 6 years, 11 months. Like,
right.
That just seems so straightforward.
Yeah. And we've had other ones where people have, you know, oh, I forgot, you know, it was 20 years ago, and I thought it was dismissed. Okay. And sometimes they say, oh, you know, it was dismissed, but it still shows up, you know, when you guys do the FBI search. Come on. I mean, you know, this was, how would you forget this episode ever? And it's only, what, a year old? Two years old?
Yeah.
A year and a half old?
Well, and as it relates to the practice of architecture, you have to be truthful and when you stamp and seal your plans. You know, so... truthfulness is direct correlation to the practice as I see it. I don't know if the architects want to say any more to that.
We gave him plenty of,
I stamp my plans and I'm truthful? Of course. I don't see how that's related.
Well, I mean, he lied on the application, then we gave an opportunity to explain why he forgot and he didn't. Then we gave him an opportunity to appear before the board, and he didn't. I don't know, if he really wanted to get licensed, I would have hoped he would have been forthcoming.
Been available for this call.
Forthcoming. Yeah. Did he know we were going to call?
I just received an email from Rod.
Rob contacted him and got his phone number. Yeah.
So he knew today was today. Today.
And I think the email specified if he had any questions about the board meeting that Rob had contacted him to talk to me and he never contacted me.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's pretty clear.
So you want to make a motion, Neil?
Mr. Chair, I make the motion that we deny the application for Kyle Markey.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Do we want to have any more discussion? And I think, Mr. Donald, did you need us to articulate why we're moving for denial?
And there is one other point as well that I should bring up. There would be a distinction between whether he lied on the application itself or whether he lied in his explanation. And the reason that becomes important is because under the materials he provided, he did apply for an early termination and discharge from deferred adjudication community supervision. And it looks like that was granted in March of 2017. I'm not authorized to practice in Texas. I've not had experience in the Texas criminal system. But the court ordered early termination discharge from the deferred adjudication and then dismissed the proceedings. That could mean one of two different things. If it's analogous to Arizona's Prop 200 laws with the pot, it could be a deferred adjudication where if you complete all the requirements, they actually just hold off on an adjudication and they dismiss the proceedings entirely, so you never actually have a conviction. They never actually proceed through the conviction process for you. Or it could be a dismissal of the proceedings after the fact, so he's terminated from his sentence, so to speak. I'm not familiar enough with Texas law to be able to answer that one right off the bat. So whether or not he lied about whether he's been convicted could be a really splitting hairs kind of question based on Texas law, which I simply can't answer at the moment. If the issue is lying in his explanation, that would be up to the committee or the board to determine whether or not he did. As I read it, there are some differences certainly between the police report and what he provided to the board in terms of what occurred, and they would be pretty significant sort of differences. So depending on the basis that the board finds, you know, I would want an enunciation of basis.
Well, I guess he has an appeals process.
As well.
Yeah.
Have you ever been arrested? So would you clearly have been arrested?
Okay, he
arrested for or convicted of.
Okay, and I take that one back. I didn't realize he'd also marked noted arrested. Okay, yeah, so it would be the arrested lying on the application, not the convicted of the crime necessarily.
Yep, and I think that's the more serious one, is the lying on the application more than embellishing his story.
But I think it's all a combination.
Yeah, it sets
stack
a pattern.
Stack
yeah.
On, yeah. So we have a motion and a second, correct?
Yeah. Is there any additional discussion? And so, Mr. Donald and staff, just for your guidance, I think what we're saying is that we're denying the license because of the lying on the application and another proceedings with the board, and are concerned that that might lead in the future to not being truthful in his practice and hiding potential mistakes that hurt the public. So, okay. Let's take the vote. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passes. All right. Melissa, you're up 10A, budget update, in your director report. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Donald.
Actually, a very good point's been put up. I've had you. I think that does need to be a roll call.
Oh, okay.
Roll call vote.
Roll call vote. Okay.
Really?
Well, what's the law about? Well, the denial of an application?
That's it.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Or if you take a board action at a hearing, when you take a formal disciplinary action, you need to do a roll call vote.
Any disciplinary action? Or?
I'll ask the expert to look at it since I'm not an attorney. I just
yes, for Mo, we'll do a roll call on this, and we'll try to make sure in the future that if that has to be all disciplinary based on new statutes, we'll make sure that for all this work.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's probably something we should know.
Okay. Dr. Alan Greenfield.
Aye.
Jack Gilmore.
Aye.
Neil Jones.
Aye.
Jason Foose.
Aye.
Jason Madison.
Aye.
Carmen Mikoff.
Aye.
Stephen Knoll.
Aye.
Andrew Everode.
Aye.
Eugene Montgomery.
Aye.
Unanimous.
In the interest of brevity for the director's report, I would just like to tell you I met with the governor's office representative yesterday, and I did that intentionally because we've had several phone calls from the governor's office about concerned home inspectors on different issues. So since we had a robust home inspector meeting, I brought her a draft of the home inspector minutes, which clearly illustrate kind of a dichotomy that we see in the occupation. There are some individuals like Mr. Leeds, who really would love us to call them a profession, and others who want to seat at this board. And then there are those who want the standards for certification to be as minimal as possible and as least expensive. And there's that rub that they see regularly at the meeting. And so I explained that to her. I also explained to her that they bring in about $100,000 in revenue a year and cost us five times that to administer the program. Seriously, with three FTEs and their employee-related expenses, times the factor of three that you gentlemen helped me determine when we were talking about cost of investigation a few years back, it's $553,000 a year, more or less, to administer this program, yes, which is a large burden on the engineers and architects, as well as the other populations here. So I wanted her to understand that, as well as to understand that we do take all home inspector matters seriously here. I told her that they are 3% of our population and 34% of our enforcement actions. And she wrote all of that down, informed me that the governor and his staff are now gearing up to consider what to pursue in the next legislative session. And she asked me what I thought about the home inspector program in general. And I said, I believe they need to be regulated. I think the real estate industry also believes they need to be regulated. But perhaps to offset the cost to this board, that they might consider moving them to a home that could better accommodate them for less money. And I threw out several boards because she said, well, who else could do it? And I said, well, real estate could do it, or Department of Financial Institutions, where the governor moved the appraisal board several years ago, as well as ROC, with some statutory tweaks. Do I believe that will happen? No. I think we're going to end up still regulating them, but I wanted to have that dialogue with her so she understood that we're not just willy-nilly coming up with standards and rules. And I told her about the rules process that we had gone through with our first challenge this month. She seemed pleased about that. And then she asked me what else was going on and, what else I thought about what was happening in, regulation generally. And I said that I hope she didn't think that all of the smaller boards and commissions were making uninformed decisions and were led by executive directors that perhaps needed more guidance, because we certainly were not among that group. She said she understood that and believed that to be the case, which I thought was positive. And she asked me about our budget submission, which I said we had all looked at the last meeting, and that we were requesting $150,000 to provide for online renewals. We spoke in great depth about the disaster that was GL Solutions. Her eyes glazed over, and at that point I knew the meeting was going to come to a close. But I thought it was productive in the sense that she knows we are serious about regulation. We are following our laws and trying to do our best. I wasn't successful in getting any information about what decisions they may be making about legislation in the coming session, but I think that discussion, honestly, has just started happening. She has no new information about replacing
either Alejandro or Jay Mad, who may end up, or reappointing Steve and Neil. No information whatsoever. I have no idea what that means. It could just be that the policy decision makers who are looking at reappointments and new appointments are just caught up in the governor's campaign. I don't know. But she seemed pleased to know that we had dedicated members who were willing to serve until they were reappointed or replaced. So you'll get another medal next year.
Well, unless Jesse doesn't win the governor, and then I'll just be gone.
You will?
Yeah, I'm sure. Hmm. Well, hard to believe,
see.
I know.
We'll see. So I just wanted to inform you about that.
Probably all be gone.
As well as the home inspectors would really like me to write a letter to ROC requesting a meeting to talk about the differences between home inspections and the fact that the builders seem to be prohibiting home inspectors from doing lawful home inspections on new builds. They're trying very hard to limit new home buyer abilities to determine whether their construction techniques are up to par. Mm-hmm. So if you're cool with that, I could write that letter and share it with you.
On what? I think it's good that the home inspectors are going in looking at the new buildings.
Right.
The home builders are
not letting them go on roofs. They're not letting them bring ladders to check things out. They're limiting the kinds of inspection, the required inspection elements.
How can they do that?
They can't legally. But if they do allow home inspectors to review new home sites to do inspections, they're requiring crazy stuff, like you have to get insurance.
Yeah, to like millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Indemnification.
Right. You know, like if you get injured on our job site, you have to have separate insurance to cover yourself for that, on and on and on. So I think it's worth discussing with the ROC. Whether we get that far, I don't know, but I think to go on the record with a formal letter requesting that, explaining the problem and requesting a meeting.
I think it's needed.
Yeah.
I really do, because it's such shoddy work. Yeah. That's why they don't want it in there.
Right.
Because they see.
Put that in a letter.
I will.
Do.
Mr. Jones.
Let me go. I'll go with you. Absolutely.
You can comment. If they are willing to meet with us and you want to come, that's
fine.
What
if they start talking about walls?
Hmm?
What if they start talking about walls?
Maybe not.
So unless you have questions, in the interest of brevity, that's my report.
Wow. I did have a question about the NCWS thing.
Jason?
What? Who was out of their mind on this thing?
Yeah.
Wait, where are you at, Jason?
The NCWS under National Council News.
Yeah, I received publications from other than NCWS where they were quoted as having defended a challenge to the fundamentals exam from, I'm not sure the exact group, but yeah, speculating that there was bias against women who did not pass the FE as in largest numbers as the men because, you know, there was something biased about the test. NCWS responded to the article and said that's not true. We have representatives who come and look for bias while they're doing examination reviews and reviewing questions for substance and all the rest. And yeah, but it was published, so I thought you'd find that interesting.
How do you have gender bias on determining the stress in a beam?
I know.
I just don't get that at all. Don't get it.
I'm glad you read my report, Jim.
I did. I read that. I started laughing. I'm like, what is this?
This agenda was only 700 pages. We actually read it.
Yeah, it was a short one.
Yep.
I know I'm being a pest with this, but I'll continue to ask until we get answered. Has ABET responded to a request after the NCEES meeting?
They have not, sir.
Okay, we'll do the standing committee reports. L&R committee.
Okay.
Nothing.
Possible meeting October.
Who's in L&R right now from the board?
Ed
was.
Ed, Jake, who is on representing surveyors. We have Bill Greenslade, who works with Steve, Leroy. We invite Doug Folk, but he's been super busy. And, no.
So you only,
and
Jason's the only board
Stanley.
Person?
Okay. Jason's now the only current sitting board member. So if anyone else wants to come, you're welcome. I just
Madison?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Well, Bob Stanley
yeah.
is sort of on. He also has been pretty busy. So that's been the real difficulty, is getting a quorum for the committee to meet, because these guys are all super busy, as you understand.
Okay. So anything to report, Jason, from L&R?
Nope. No?
Just a possible meeting. Okay. Home inspectors, anything we haven't talked about today?
Nothing we haven't talked about.
That's the whole meeting.
Okay, outside activities, ASBOG.
October.
Are the train geologists going to?
We're going to bring a couple.
You know that Texas is looking at deregulating geoscientists. So that's the big issue. And if Texas does it, you know we're going to see it.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Clarb?
It goes to price of oil.
Yes, we're doing one thing.
We're leaving tomorrow.
Analysis. I'm really curious to hear it.
Oh, Clarb conference in Toronto. Patty and I are leaving tomorrow.
Nice.
Ooh.
And Clarb. Anything? Do you know anything?
I'm going by myself to the meeting in St. Louis, so just so you know.
When is it again?
Really?
It's too late. You can't.
Oh, okay.
October 12th.
Oh, well.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah,
I know.
Well,
okay. NCES, we touched on the allegation, and I don't believe there's any new news. We know there's a new
executive director.
CEO, yeah.
I nominated Alejandra for his own award.
You did, huh?
I did. Mm-hmm.
What award?
The regional award. Because he's
important.
A contributor.
Nice. How come he didn't nominate me?
He does. He contributes. He's been on committees since before he served on the board. He's been serving on the board even after his time here has expired. And he's been involved in the deregulatory things. And you want an award too? I'll nominate
sure.
you. Okay.
But you have to go to an NCES meeting.
No, I won't go.
It's a requirement.
You won your award.
Cool.
So, yes, I did. Oh,
thank you, Melissa. Future board meetings, September 23rd.
And November 19th.
Yeah. And 11/19, that's right. Topics for future agendas, anything?
Avid again. We'll put that out.
Inspectors.
But I also wanted to bring up again the issue of outreach. You know, we said that we wanted to try and participate somehow, but we need somebody needs to extend invitation to the board or want to engage us. I spoke with members of the ASME, okay, which is our professional society, but I'm sure ASCE, IEEE, the whole gamut, you know, alphabet soup there. Would want to engage the board, and I really don't know how best to coordinate this. You know, in times past, we used to have like the NSPE, which is like the professional lobbying arm of PE, engage these parties to solicit more enrollment by students or even young professionals in getting their license. So it's just something I can't do myself. We need, by extension, an organization. I'd be happy to speak at any student organization of SWE, ASME, IEEE, ASE. You know, they must have student groups at, you know, in Tempe yep. or in Tucson. So that's just some, you know, just an open invitation again. I don't know how to coordinate that, Alejandro, but
I think we definitely need to do that. I'm happy to go anywhere as well, you know that.
Actually, Alejandro just spoke at the Women in Transportation for NSPE last week.
Yeah, ASB and ASC were there too.
Yeah, and we do put it out there. We email these people periodically and say, if you want us to come and speak. We do. I do. I just haven't heard back.
Yeah.
So at least the offer's there.
Please contact ASU.
Yeah, and I know you have a in at ASU. So,
yeah. I do it all the time.
But Neil hosts an open bar, and that's why they go to Jen's. Stop!
The secret.
Right.
When's the next one of that?
Every day.
Every day.
Every day at Neil's office.
So, you know, if you guys are contacted and they say we'd love to have someone speak, as long as my nose doesn't explode or some other catastrophic thing doesn't occur, we're happy. And if it isn't me, it's Doug goes and speaks at association meetings. Rob, I've been sending to the NSPE meeting. They have a luncheon. He loves going for the free lunch at the U Club. And Patty's spoken.
We're getting off topic, yeah. So maybe the issue is not that we're not willing to speak. The issue is maybe we need to have an outreach plan to figure out how to have people invite us to speak. And
We'll put it on a future event to discuss plans.
So, Gene, whatever happened last year with Plumbing Association, registering plumbing?
Yeah, no, they didn't go anywhere. That did not go anywhere. I think it was brought up at one of the meetings I attended, ACTIS annual NCEES. I think his name Miller. Had brought up the plumbing issue, and there wasn't enough interest nationally to generate a test specification.
Okay.
Any other items? All right. We need a motion, right? Okay.
I move. We move.
Move what?
Adjourn?
Okay, good. Second?
Move out of here.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
All right, we're done.
Thank you.
This was going to be short.